Blog Talk Radio.
Goody. Well, what the heck?
If you love America, you're among friends here.
Tune in for the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann Show, Sundays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, to discuss current events, news, and political opinion with Lucid Libertarian flair. I promote liberty, freedom, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and limited government, while speaking against corporate and government corruption, tyranny, and the globalist Great Reset agenda that undermines our precious American sovereignty. Please also like and follow my Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann page on Facebook. You can help me battle their freedom-loathing censorship by visiting my page regularly, along with reacting, commenting, and sharing my posts. Thank you, and I hope listening to my show becomes part of your Sunday night routine.
Conservative Nation Media has been around for 11 years now to give you the news that is fit to know about the state of America and what the politicians in Washington and around our nation are doing to our freedoms. We have strived to give you the true news that you cannot find in the lamestream lying liberal media, and because of our love for this great nation, we are growing again. With new shows on CNN like American Statesman with Sally Baptiste and Crazy Nation Radio with Ron Reck, we are getting well-known names to join our network to make CNN a stronger voice for America. We have others who may be joining us too. American Statesman airs on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and Crazy Nation Radio airs mostly on Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, with other times of the week when he feels the need is there. Join Conservative Nation Media for all of our shows on Friday, Saturday, Monday, and Tuesday with our Sunday show, American by Design, returning too. That's Conservative Nation Media, where America always wins.
Go ahead.
But what we saw in that Senate today was a cowardly group of Republicans who apparently have no option to take.
Show me where it said that protest is supposed to be polite and peaceful.
About your dad's immigration practices, you feckless.
They go low,
he kicks. How do you resist the temptation to run up and wring her neck?
The biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized right to the right.
I thought you should have punched him in the face. So even if you lost, he insulted your wife.
Yes.
He came down the escalator and called Mexicans rapists and murderers. He said, well, what do you think I should have done? So I think you should have punched him in the face and then gotten out of the race. You would have been a hero.
I'd like to punch him in the face. If I said we're in high school, I'd take him behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
Punch some people in the face!
When was the last time an actor assassinated a president?
It's amazing how people try to frame everything racially and how they create divisions among our society.
That's one small step for man. One giant leap for mankind.
Number one of NWCR Radio with your host, Robert Garding.
This is Stu Brooks of Radio Free Delmarva from 92.7 WGMD, Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, and I'm proud to introduce my friend Robert as we fight to protect the America we know and love. Through the silver microphone of freedom with the voice of reason in this unreasonable world, you're listening to NWCR Radio, broadcast through the CNM network in Albuquerque, New Mexico, from our Freedom Studio. And now, here's Robert.
Good afternoon, good evening to everybody. Yesterday was Pearl Harbor Day. One of the things that kind of dismayed me about the whole thing was that I found very little in the news and even in the conservative news sites about it, which was kind of weird. But I found one article that was in Newsmax, and it talked about the Pearl Harbor attack survivors returning 82 years later. And it says Ira Ike Schaub had just showered, put on a clean sailor's uniform, and closed his locker aboard the USS Dobbin when he heard a call for a fire rescue party. He went topside to see the USS Utah capsizing and Japanese planes in the air. He scurried below to grab boxes of ammunition and join a daisy chain of sailors sending or feeding shells to an anti-aircraft gun above. He remembers being only 140 pounds as a 21-year-old, but somehow finding the strength to lift the boxes weighing almost twice that. "We were pretty startled," he said, "startled and scared to death." And he's now 103, and he lives in Beaverton, Oregon, where he lives with his daughter. He said, "We didn't know what to expect, and we knew that if anything happened to us, that would be it." Schaub returned to Pearl Harbor Thursday, 82 years later, on the anniversary of the attack, to remember the more than 2,300 servicemen killed. He was one of the five survivors at a ceremony commemorating the assault that propelled the United States into World War II. Six of the increasingly frail men had been expected, but one was not feeling well, organizers said. The aging pool of Pearl Harbor survivors has been rapidly shrinking. There is now just one crew member of the USS Arizona still living, 102-year-old Lou Conter of California. 2 years ago, survivors who attended the 80th anniversary remembrance ceremony ranged in age from 97 to 103. They'll be even older this time. David Kilton, the National Park Service's Interpretation, Education, and Visitor Services lead for Pearl Harbor, noted that for many years, survivors frequently volunteered to share their experiences with visitors at the historic site. That's not possible anymore. "We could be the best storytellers in the world, and we can't really hold a candle to those that lived it and shared their stories firsthand," Kilton said. "But now that we are losing that generation and we won't have them very much longer, the opportunity shifts to reflect even more so on the sacrifices that were made, the stories that they did share." The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs doesn't keep statistics for how many Pearl Harbor survivors are still living, but the department data shows that of the 16 million who served in World War II, only about 120,000 were alive as of October, and an estimated 131 die each day. There were about 87,000 military personnel on Oahu at the time of the attack, according to a rough estimate compiled by military historian J. Michael Wegner. Schaub never spoke much of Pearl Harbor until about a decade ago. He's since been sharing his story with his family, student groups, and history buffs, and he's returned to Pearl Harbor several times since. The reason? He said, to pay honor to the guys that didn't make it. This is something that we all have to start looking at, because these men fought the first battle of the United States in World War II. There's not many of them left. And what happens in our nation on Pearl Harbor Day anymore is kind of a shame, because nothing, pretty much nothing, was said about it yesterday.
Nope, nothing. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Disgusting.
And that was that article that I just, well, there was about two more lines left of it, but that article that I read was essentially the only thing I found about
it. Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
Isn't that terrible?
And I looked in Newsmax. That came from Newsmax. I looked in Breitbart. There was nothing there. I looked in One America News. There was nothing there. I looked in, I even looked in the Pinion Post here. That, of course, there was nothing there.
You could have went to my Facebook page. I posted a couple videos.
I should have, yes.
Yeah.
But that just kind of blew me away, because even on the radio, of course, I didn't really listen to talk radio yesterday like I normally do. They may have said something about it, because they have said something every year, you know, since I started listening to them. But, and even last year they said stuff about it, but I didn't hear anything this year. But it's probably because I didn't listen.
So, oh, I know it's bad. It's bad. It's sad. It really is.
Yeah, it is. It's real sad. And it just kind of made me even sadder for the men that are still alive.
Oh, I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just brought Mike in.
Every so often they'll replay. I'll go back and I'll look at Battle 360, which is on YouTube, which is all about the Enterprise, the aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from World War II. And as it turns out, I'm looking at a thing here that says that there weren't very many, other than the battleships, other than the Arizona and one other one, they only lost two ships permanently at Pearl Harbor. The rest of them were able to be fixed. And really, if you think about it, you look at the fact that the carrier group was out at sea at the time when this happened. That was a big deal. They didn't lose the carriers.
As of October of this year, there's 120,000 people alive from World War II that served in World War II. 131 die each day.
Yep.
So I don't know how many are alive from Pearl Harbor, because it doesn't say. So, but the oldest surviving member from Pearl Harbor is 101 years old right now.
Well, the guy that I talked about in the story, his name is Ira Ike Schaub. He is 103 right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're getting to that point. They're all getting to that point where they're going to be dying off. They're getting to the point where they're 98, 99, 100 years old, you know? And how much longer are they going to live, right? I mean,
there's fewer than 75 left. There's 75,
yeah,
there's fewer than 75, they say. 75
yeah,
people. Wow.
And that one guy that I talked about, that Ira Schaub, he is 103, and he went to Pearl Harbor yesterday and actually spoke. And at 103, that's amazing.
yeah, man.
Wow. I mean, think about this. We're talking about Pearl Harbor, but think about the people that the Band of Brothers is about. a lot of those guys are dead as well, you know, because that was done a couple decades ago.
You're right. He's right. Sorry to interrupt you, but he's right. 103 years old. Yep, I got it right here, the article. Yep. Wow. Yep. Wow. Man. Crazy, man. Just think, by next year, they'll probably all be dead. Next 1 or 2 years, there'll be no living testimony to that. No living testimony.
Yeah, that's sad. And I think did I just bring Sarge in?
Hey, Sarge.
Yeah, you sure did. And I got to share you guys' sentiment about the lack of commemoration of that awful yet inspiring day. Are you guys aware there were 16 Medals of Honor awarded to service members for that day? 16. Your stories are simply incredible. What they did that day was simply incredible. I mean, amazing.
They said the bodies are still buried in the ship. The bodies are still in the ships.
Oh, it's a grave. It's a grave. The Arizona is a grave. So that's their tomb.
You know,
but
no,
I'm just saying that the 16 men who won the Medal of Honor was one of them, a quartermaster who stayed at his station while it was flooding, and he knew he'd probably drown, to keep the power on as long as he could so he could get other men out. He sacrificed his life in order to save his mates. He didn't directly engage the enemy aircraft that were attacking Pearl Harbor, but what he did was every bit as heroic, and he died at his station.
Yeah.
I mean, all the stories like that of all of those men that day. The other 15 men have similar stories.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You know, and that guy that I was talking about that's 103, the story that I was reading for him, you know, not many people can imagine their day starting out with a shower and then getting dressed and going up and finding out you're in the middle of a battle. And he went back down to start help carry ammunition up to the anti-aircraft guns.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They were caught off guard. They were warned, but they were ignored. They were ignored because of government gridlock, and big-headed idiots
Well, speaking of idiots, you know, I want to add idiots, but they miscalculated. Now, think about the Japanese. At the beginning of the Pacific War, with attack on Pearl Harbor, the Japanese had the most advanced, best carrier forces in the world. They had the best pilots with the most advanced carrier fighter aircraft ever, the Zero. And like I said, they had the very best trained and experienced pilots. I mean, the selection process for Japanese pilots, especially fighter pilots, was rigorous. It was really over the top. And they were highly trained to a T. I mean, they were the elite. And they had everything going for them as far as that at that stage. Like my man was just saying a few minutes ago, they missed the carrier fleet. They were hidebound in the sense that they thought the battleship, the battle line of the battleships, was the most powerful striking force still, despite all they had done to develop carrier aviation. And they thought by destroying the battle fleet, well, the United States would give up. They'd be able to consolidate their perimeter in the Pacific after they took Indonesia and Malaya and the Philippines, and that would be it. They weren't counting on a long, drawn-out war. They actually thought the United States would cry uncle. And when they missed the opportunity to get the American carrier fleet, that was it for them, because the industrial might of the United States was going to carry the day at the end of the day. When they didn't win and they were beaten in Midway, it was over. From that point on in the war, they were on a strategic defensive, and the United States victory was inevitable. The only question was, how long was it going to take?
Yep.
Why did they think we were going to surrender? What were they thinking?
They believed their own propaganda, that the United States was soft, decadent, and weak. They believed their own propaganda.
Well, one of the things I remember hearing was that when we started to go into World War II, we had no equipment. We had no guns. Our soldiers that were training with wooden rifles. They didn't have guns to train with.
That's a bit of an overstatement, but yeah, essentially you're correct. What they had was obsolescent or barely worn out. It wasn't up to date. They just passed the National Mobilization Act by one vote. One vote. They were able to draft people into the active duty for a year. If that hadn't been in place, they wouldn't have had as many people. Huh?
Roosevelt, Arch. Roosevelt was an idiot, you know? He was a Democrat.
No, he was the
idiot.
One that was behind it. I mean, he didn't veto it. I mean, he didn't veto that law when it was passed. He was encouraging. Remember, he's the president. He doesn't pass legislation. Congress passed the Marshall Mobilization Act by one vote. One.
Yep.
It almost failed in the House of Representatives.
Yeah. Well, I mean, still, it just goes to show you, the United States, it's impossible to invade us and win. It'd be impossible for any country to invade us and win. You know, think about it.
I don't know if it's impossible, but it's going to be one hard-fought thing. Because like Yamamoto said, Admiral, the brilliant Japanese Admiral, Isoroku Yamamoto, he said, if you invade the United States, there's going to be a rifleman behind every blade of grass. And he knew that about, because remember, he studied in the United States. He admired the United States. He thought it was kind of crazy to go to war against the United States. But he said this, okay, if we're going to go to war, I can promise you this, 6 months to a year of victories. I can run wild in the Pacific. After that, we haven't gained victory. I cannot assure you of anything. And he was absolutely correct. Japanese cut a swath through American forces from the Aleutian Islands all the way through to the Philippines. And the British in Indonesia and Malaysia, the Japanese had one of the most spectacularly successful blitzkriegs on a huge scale because of the distances involved. And it looks like they were going to be triumphant. They were defeating everyone in their path. They sunk the Repulse. They sunk the Prince of Wales. They took the Malaysia with a brilliant campaign. They just completely outmaneuvered the British. Did the same thing in Singapore. You know, we know what they did in the Pacific. They did Guam, Wake Island.
They played dirty, man. They sit there at nighttime with their submarines and ambush ships, you know. They played dirty.
Oh, no, you're thinking about the Germans. The Japanese didn't have much of a submarine fleet that attacked. Here's where the Japanese screwed up. Japanese screwed up by not trying to go after our merchant shipping. See, the Germans knew that the merchant shipping sinking was important. They had a spectacularly successful campaign from January of 1942 to June of 1942, where they sunk 500 merchant and American naval warships. 500 in a six-month period. They were really kicking ass on the eastern seaboard of the United States.
Still couldn't take us out.
Yeah, to your point, Sarge.
Well, I'm just saying it, but the Japanese didn't do that. The Japanese thought the purpose of submarines, see, their doctrine said that what we are going to do, unlike the Germans, who went after merchant shipping, which was really the proper target because it was an economic target, Japanese thought that submarines were for screening the fleet and attacking enemy naval warships, not merchant shipping. That's where they blew it. See, the American submarine campaign looked at the German model and said, that's the way we're going to do it. And they almost completely wiped out the Japanese merchant fleet. That's why they were on the back foot so much, because they couldn't resupply their islands. The ships were sunk. They were being sunk by our aircraft and mainly by the submarines, because the submarine arm alone, you're talking about maybe 20,000 men in all the fleet submarines, sunk about over 60% of the Japanese merchant fleet by themselves. Just submarine force.
Yeah, to your point, Sarge, when America went, I believe, into the Marianas Islands, one of the most important ships they sunk was this merchant ship that bottlenecked into a strait. That when they sunk that ship, it cut off that strait in between a couple of islands where the ships couldn't go from one side of the strait to the other side of the strait.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about Truk. I think you're talking about Truk Lagoon.
Yes, yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right, they did.
They really.
Oh yeah, they did a number on the Japanese fleet in Truk Lagoon. It was a slaughter, and they did it with American dive bombers, torpedo bombers, and skip bombers, medium bombers configured to do skip bombing, like B-25s and A-20 Havocs, and they just made a mess out of the Japanese fleet in
Pearl Harbor. They shot down what 64 planes.
No, not that many. About 29. But it was remarkable they could. But wait a minute, it was remarkable that they could shoot down that many. I mean, and most of them were shot down in the second wave, because now you got all these aroused sailors and soldiers running and managed to break open arms lockers and get the weapons out and get the ammunition. Because remember, the right to keep and bear arms doesn't extend to soldiers unless they order you to get them. Right? And there wasn't anybody around. They had the keys to the arms lockers in the rooms and where the ammo was. So these guys had figured out how to break the safes and the vaults and the arms rooms open to get the ammunition out, get the automatic weapons, the anti-aircraft weapons, the ammunition room, get them unloaded, get them set up. And they had to wait for the second wave to come in, and then they were able to do some damage to it. But look, considering what the Japanese achieved at Pearl Harbor, they paid almost no price. Here's what they blew up. Here's what they messed up. Yeah, they didn't damage significantly the American battle fleet. There's no doubt about that. But here's what they did not do. They did not get the oil tanks, the tank bombs, the machine shops, and everything that was needed to repair everything that they damaged. Remember, Pearl Harbor was America's foremost forward naval station. If they had significantly damaged the machine shops and the logistics at Pearl Harbor, then the American Pacific Fleet would have had to stage from the west coast of the United States. That would have been a big impediment.
Yeah, it was 64 service members, 64 service member and 29 planes, yeah.
Yeah, 29 planes. So, I mean, look, that's remarkable considering they were completely unprepared. I mean, they fought back courageously. I mean, they damaged more, but I don't know how many they damaged. They did damage some others that did make it back to the carriers. But the thing that is, though, is that considering what they achieved, they paid almost no price for it. They attacked with over 300 aircraft in the fourth area. And so that means their casualty rate was not even 8% or 6%.
They destroyed 169 of our planes, 169.
Yep.
And guess what? Right. They were all stacked together, because guess what they feared? Instead of them being dispersed as they would be if they were fearing an air attack, they had them all concentrated together. You know why they had them concentrated together? Because they were afraid of sabotage. They thought somebody was going to come in on foot and try to sabotage the aircraft. They didn't think it was going to be. If they had been an air attack, they would have had them dispersed. But they wanted them concentrated together, so the guards could walk around them and spot them easier and maybe catch the saboteur more easily. They wouldn't need as many personnel to secure the aircraft that were there. But as we know, they were wrong. It wasn't the Japanese citizens on Pearl Harbor, for the most part, who were a threat at all. It was the Japanese embassy personnel and the spies they sent there to spot the layout at Pearl Harbor, because the Japanese embassy personnel and the spies they had there, they were scoping out Pearl Harbor and mapping everything out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But they were doing that in broad daylight. They were walking around like tourists in broad daylight.
Yeah, now you can see why, though, that they rounded up the Japanese, though, and put them in camps. I mean, wouldn't you if you were, you know,
It still wasn't justified. They were supposed to get due process before they got put up there. They didn't get due process.
Not all of them were citizens, Sarge. Not all of them were citizens. Not all.
Yeah, some of them were resident aliens, and that's different. Some of them were Japanese citizens. Now, Japanese citizens, it's okay to intern them. I mean, that's standard. I mean, American citizens in Japan were interned, and Japanese citizens on U.S. soil and territory were interned. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm only speaking about the American citizens who were of Japanese descent. They did not get due process. The Constitution was not suspended during World War II on American soil.
No.
Constitution can never be suspended. They never suspend the Constitution, never.
Well, that's what I said. They didn't get due process, Joe.
I know.
I mean, they were American citizens, and they were rounded up and interned. Listen, let me spell it. I got to keep stressing this. They were American citizens.
Yep.
They weren't internees from another country. That's a different kettle of fish.
Yep. Yeah, that's you can intern people. I mean, these were people who, you know, had been here for a couple of generations. You know, it's not like they just,
yes,
you know,
Nisa.
Immigrated here. You know, they were like, you know, second, third generation people that were rounded up. And yeah, I'm here in Oregon, you know, alongside in Portland, alongside the Willamette River. Along the park is a memorial to, you know, to the Japanese that were interned and stuff. I mean, right here where I'm at, you know, was very involved in that, and it's sickening. It's absolutely sickening. That is something we can never allow to happen again, and it is something that during COVID there was an awful lot of politicians that wanted to do the exact same thing to people that did not want to get back. You know, they wanted to ship us all off and contain us, like, you know, basically an unjabbed COVID, you know, COVID unjabbed
lock them up.
Maybe
mainstream media didn't mention
much about Pearl Harbor, because that brings up the fact that we interned all these Japanese Americans,
yeah,
and boy, that, you know, that's really, really too familiar. We don't want to remind people of that, you know.
Well, if you got an individualized case of espionage against anybody of any descent who is engaged in espionage, you bring the charges against them and you take them to court. But they just rounded them up and threw them all in camps, willy nilly.
Yeah.
It was Franklin Roosevelt that signed that executive order to do it.
Yep.
Yep.
Dirtbag.
Well, that's a good job by Sarge, man. I'm glad you actually hold to principle and speaking about that internment situation.
No.
Good job, Sarge.
No.
Well, you should be, because, you know, I know what the deal is when it comes to this.
I know.
And I can make no exceptions for the truth.
I know that Pearl Harbor was kind of well planned by the Japanese, but what would have happened if instead of June 7th, they waited until like June 10th or June 11th, when the carrier fleet was probably going to be in at Pearl Harbor, and then what? Then they would have got the carrier fleet.
Okay.
Yep.
It would have been a different war altogether, because that carrier fleet that defeated the Japanese at Midway would probably have been at the bottom of Pearl Harbor and not yet restored. Now, you got to remember, the Yorktown was damaged in the Battle of the Coral Sea, which was a month before the Battle of Midway. They brought the Yorktown back to Pearl Harbor and said, it's going to take us 3 months to get this ship ready. I said, oh, hell no. They got every single workman they could find. I mean, every single worker they could find throughout the region. They sunned them all in there. Said work day and night, no rest, 24-hour shifts until you get the thing ready to go back to sea to get back with the other two carriers. And they did. They worked on that ship night and day, no rest, three shifts constantly going. And when they didn't have it completed, when they ordered it out to sea, there were still workmen on the Yorktown finishing up the last stages as it was sailing. But the Yorktown was critical in defeating the Japanese fleet at Midway. And look, if those carriers had not been there at Midway to stop the Japanese fleet, they probably would have taken Midway. They would have had a forward base from which to threaten the island of Oahu, and generally Hawaii. They would have probably been able to invade Hawaii, take Hawaii and threaten the West Coast of the United States and all kinds of naval assets that no longer existed would have had to rush westward to the Pacific coast to be prepared to stop a Japanese invasion of the West Coast. It would have been a different war. Completely.
Oh, my God. Hey, does anyone know how to do a screen share on the live video feed on Facebook? Anybody know how to do screen share? I can't figure it out for the life of me.
I'm looking.
I don't know. There's got to be a feature on there, right? I mean, I just don't know how to. I can't find it. I just can't find it.
Anyway, guys, think about this. We're looking at, the Yorktown, the Enterprise, the Intrepid, the Hornet, the Lexington. These are all that was that carrier group, right? Those carriers, the Franklin, the USS Franklin, those were all those carriers. And so, and really, what was the Hornet that ended up sending planes that struck back at Japan? Under that pile,
that was in April of 42, Jimmy Doolittle, in April.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Doolittle, 1942.
So that was a big deal. And if the Hornet was there in Pearl Harbor, we wouldn't have had the Doolittle raid.
And what did the Doolittle raid lead to? Remember, it caused the Japanese to step up their plans to take Midway. The Japanese were not planning to take Midway when they did. What happened was, even though the raid was just a pinprick, I mean, you had, 8 bombers with a 1-ton bomb load. I mean, what damage is that going to do, really? But it did upset the Japanese very much. They had to apologize to the emperor and say they were taking steps to make sure this wouldn't happen again. And so they stepped up their plans to take Midway. And remember, the Aleutians, Kiska and Attu, which was a diversion for the real intent to take Midway. So you got a diversionary assault attack that took Kiska and Attu, which, by the way, was American soil. Now, Kiska and Attu were actually American outposts. That was our soil, just as much as Alaska was. And they took it, and they hoped to divert the American fleet up there, thinking that the Japanese are trying to come to invade the United States through Alaska. Meantime, they went to Midway and they attacked Midway, and all their plans were upset as a result. And the Doolittle raid was critical in that it upset the Japanese timetable, caused them to change their plans, and led to their one-sided, complete, decisive, strategic defeat at Midway. Didn't do any damage.
All right.
In a strategic sense.
No, but it got into their heads. That's what they've said. I've seen the whole thing about the history of that thing on the History Network about the history of the Enterprise, And when they talked about the Hornet and the Doolittle raid, they knew it wasn't going to mean much. They just said, "We're coming to, we can come and get you anytime we want to." That's the thing.
It was a morale raiser. But it was hugely strategically significant because it caused the Japanese to change their timetable and step up their plans to take Midway, and it led to their disaster. So it was huge. It was huge in that respect.
And think
huge.
About this. What Pearl Harbor led to is, one, the Japanese had the better pilots and the better plane at the start of the war.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
But halfway, 344, whatever it was, we go from the Wildcat to the Hellcat. All right? Better plane.
Yeah.
The
Hellcat was built to be a zero.
The biggest lesson that was taught at Pearl Harbor was, at the time, the United States Navy did not know what to do with the carriers. They had no idea what the carriers were and what to use them for and how to use them. Well, at Pearl Harbor, they all got their lesson and they all got their answer.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they didn't
know
what
an idea, but they were still...
They didn't know how to use their aircraft carriers, you're saying?
No, they were developing doctrine.
The admirals had no idea what to do with their aircraft carrier or how to use them in battle how to use them at all. They were still working the plans of a battleship and a battleship navy.
Yes.
You got to figure out the usefulness of it. You got to have game theory from previous battles and all of that. All of that information wasn't available yet. So, yeah, they were figuring out as they went. But, again, you guys are talking about a war where one side has meager resources. They have to stitch everything together. And, yeah, okay, you have better fighters, but how many of them you got? You know, that's a problem already. And then that kind of goes into their ideology. When you think about the kamikaze fighters, they're thinking with, you know, dealing with big, huge warships. Their idea was, okay, if you spend X amount on that warship and I got this little stuff over here, if I sink your warship, just the deficit alone of you losing that is worth me not spending the money and trying to compete with you in big warships. So it's a lot to it. There's a, you know that guy Dan Carlin? I know Sarge knows him. Dan Carlin, who does that Hardcore History podcast, he's like a 7-part series on this war, man. It's really good. I can't think of the name of it, but Dan Carlin, Hardcore History, he covers this pretty good. It's worth checking out. It's long, though.
Ron was just saying, it's not quite right to say they didn't know what to do with it because they were developing a doctrine. They didn't know what their doctrine should be. They were still centering naval operations around a battleship, like you said. Now, that's definitely true. And they thought the carrier force was there to support the battle line rather than the other way around. Really, everything, they realized that everything had to be centered around the aircraft carrier. The aircraft carrier were not a support arm. They were the arm of decision. And that's at the Pearl Harbor, and especially at the Midway, they said, yep, this is the way we got to go from now on.
Yep.
Yeah, because they especially were especially the fact when they go into the Marianas and they have the Great Marianas turkey shoot thing that happened that they took out how many airplanes in the Marianas Islands?
345 of them in one day. Altogether, by the end of the Marianas turkey shoot, they shot down 448 Japanese aircraft. But they took out 345 of them in the first day.
Yeah, that's lost.
The first day
can't be recouped. Like you can't.
But you got to remember though, the elite Japanese aviators had been treated badly by then. In Japan, even though they had the best at the beginning, they did not have a proper replacement system and proper training system like the United States had that was second to none. And they could not replace the losses they had. That is why they were counting on a rapid victory. They knew they had to win within 6 months to a year. After that, it was hopeless against the United States.
Yep.
And what were they planning on winning, Sarge? What were they planning on winning? What did they think they were going to do? I mean,
they wanted to do. Now, a lot of people think they wanted to. They weren't going to fade in that. They had an absolutely perfect strategic opening. What they wanted to do was defeat the United States. The reason they went after the United States Pacific Fleet because it was in
they
the way of their expansion.
Yeah.
Their real goal was
exactly.
to expand in Southeast Asia. They wanted the resources of Malaysia and India. They wanted those resources.
They
needed the Dutch East Indies. They needed the rubber trees in Borneo. They needed the oil fields.
Yep.
They needed that more than they needed the United States. And what they wanted to do was defeat the United States Navy so the United States Navy would come to an armistice or a negotiated settlement, and they'd have their Pacific Ring, a Pacific Ring all the way from Formosa
all the way down through the southeast Solomons. And they would have a perimeter they could defend against any attack. That was their objective.
Yep.
Yep.
Agreed. 100%. Because honestly, without that, they had to kind of go out of the imperialism empire business because they wouldn't have had the resources to support it.
Right.
There was no way for them to
So
they figured, okay,
they're the most resource poor. Yeah. They're the most resource poor major power in the world. They had nothing. They needed rubber.
Yeah.
They needed oil. They needed iron ore. They needed chromium. They needed nickel. They needed steel. They didn't have anything. And the only place they saw to get it if they wanted to continue to wage their war on China, especially after the United States imposed the embargoes on them of petroleum and of steel and other raw materials, the only place they could see to get them was in the Dutch East Indies. Who's in the way in the Dutch East Indies? The British and the Dutch. They got to get them out of the way. But the United States is going to come to their aid if they attack because they got to go through the Pacific and the Philippines. They got to get the United States Navy out of the way. So, hey, they were caught between a rock and a hard place, but here's what they were not going to do. They were not going to abandon their imperial designs on China. That's what it was all about.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted China.
Yep.
And that's why
U.S. Navy was just in the way.
Yep. And then they didn't count on General, what's his name, going through his island hopping campaign to get back to get Americans back to Australia and back to closer to MacArthur and his campaign.
Yeah,
you
MacArthur.
Know? Yeah,
you know the conflict there, though.
But again, they knew they wouldn't get total victory. Their idea was if we can get them to make concessions, that's the whole thing. Get this over with real quick. They make these concessions, and then we're able to move on. They had no plans on like getting total victory over the United States or anything like that. They knew that wasn't possible.
Oh no! They couldn't do that. They knew.
He told the emperor, that's not possible. We don't have the resources. They do, and we will awaken a war machine that the world has never seen. Like that's what Tojo was telling that man. He's telling the emperor that to his face.
Oh, they knew. They knew that they had no hope of invading the United States and capturing any significant United States territory. But they did think they could get a rapid victory that would render the United States impotent long enough to get a negotiated settlement that would leave them alone to turn all of their resources on the Dutch East Indies and to get oil, rubber, and other resources there so they continue their war on China. They wanted China. And remember, there was a big conflict between Nimitz, Admiral Nimitz, who wanted to go through the Central Pacific to the Formosa, and General MacArthur, who wanted to go through the Solomons and the Southern Pacific in order to, eventually take back the Philippines. And MacArthur viewed it as a moral crusade because the Filipinos were so pro-American, and he saw the United States had a moral duty to go back and liberate the Filipinos from the Japanese yoke. Whereas Nimitz thought it would be more efficient to go to the Central Pacific, and they were fighting over the limited resources of the Pacific because most of them, remember, were being given to the European theater. So they had a real fight over resources to fight in the Pacific.
And just to give y'all something else to look up, y'all going to find this real strange. During that period and a little bit period before, Japan had a reverse Jim Crow law. So they had laws to where white people could not ride in first class. They were pushed to the side. They had some, like, when you think about the ideology over there, in order to have a small nation like that do what they did, you had to kind of get a certain mentality. And that mentality, I think a lot of people would be surprised when you find out culturally what was going on over there. But
where's our reparations? Where's our reparations?
Written about it. Well, I mean, sir, you need to go to the world court for that. I ain't got nothing to do with that, brother. Go talk to them.
Hey, I want you guys to tell me something.
Where? Look into it instead of weaponizing.
Yeah, I know. Naj is absolutely correct. I want you guys to tell me of any nation that you can think of in the history of mankind that went from a medieval power, a medieval culture in 1854 or so when Admiral Perry sailed in Tokyo Bay and demanded the Japanese open up their ports to world trade, And the Japanese took a look at this and all the power that was bristling against it. Oh, hell no. They ain't going to do this shit no more. We're going to get as powerful as they are. And guess what? They proceeded to modernize their empire. And in the span of 50 years, gentlemen, 50 motherfucking years, they became a world power that had defeated Russia in 1905 in the Russo-Japanese War. In 50 short years, they went from a medieval state to a major world power. That is astonishing.
Yep.
Now, they had a lot of help from the British and the Germans. They did go to the British for their navy. They went to the Germans to help their army become modern. But they adopted all the languages. They modernized their means of production. They had competent and useful infantry weapons and naval vessels. And
they took ideas from everywhere.
Yeah, they're right.
They import
trains
from the U.S., take them apart, put them back together. The discipline that they instilled in it. Now, that's the cultural little superpower that other people didn't have. Their discipline was, you messed up, okay, you just got shot. Like, there was no idea of you not falling in line or anything else. Like, their ideology was insane. It's almost fundamentalism, like you see with, like, some religious sects in certain countries or whatever. Like, that's how they approached it. But, yeah, Sarge is right. The U.S. postal system, they completely copied that. Any idea in the world that they thought was good, they took it apart, put it back together in their own way and applied it.
Yep. And in many ways, they improved on it. I mean, the Zero was a marvel of aircraft engineering. The Zero was really a neat little fighter. I mean, and remember, the United States military, those are ridiculing their ability to build anything that good. But, you know, they found, to their distress, that, yes, the Japanese have done it. Now, they did do some things that the United States wouldn't do in its aircraft. They had a different philosophy. They were looking to get range out of their aircraft, which meant they had to make them lighter. That meant they had to get rid of them. They couldn't have self-sealing fuel tanks. They couldn't have too much armor plate. They were built almost rather really lightly to be more nimble and more aerobatic. But as far as maneuverability, rate of climb, and armament, they were at the top of the game in 1941-42. But the U.S., of course, with some of the racism and some of the arrogance of the time, oh, Japanese can't do this. But yes, they did. And they had the best torpedo in the world, too, the Long Lance torpedo. And they figured out how they could make it work in the shallow waters of Pearl Harbor. They equipped that torpedo on their torpedo bombers, and that was the ones that sunk those battleships in Battleship Row.
They learned that trick from the British.
Right. Yes. Put wooden fins on the torpedo so they wouldn't sink as fast.
Right, and they also had, at the beginning of the war, they also had the best, you know, they had the Kate and the Oscar, which were their torpedo planes,
Oscar was a fighter plane, but the Kate was a torpedo bomber, but they had the Val dive bomber, which is kind of based on the Stuka. And it was very good at putting bombs on a target accurately. They had the Val and they had the Kate.
Then we got to add the cultural element of a kamikaze fighter. The only way you can get a kamikaze fighter is to have a culture to where not only is country and honor above everything else, that you could actually get people to sign up for something like that and agree that that's the best thing for them to do at that point.
Fail.
Like that.
If you fail,
just kind of like the Muslim and the suicide bombers.
Yes. If you fail,
man, but the Japanese, look, you got to remember though, the Japanese,
they would
fight to the
death. No Muslim country that has a battalion of those though. Those are like sleeper cells or small groups who are extremists who they can hype up to do the suicide bombers. But they don't have a whole wing, a whole army of folks who are willing to do it.
They had a kamikaze corps.
Wait a minute. You got to remember, okay, let the suicide bombers go out one at a time, and they go out all over the place. You know, their numbers aren't that less than what the Japanese had with their kamikaze pilots. The suicide bombers is dispersed. the kamikaze pilots were not dispersed.
No, they're concentrated. You can't create ranks of those. You see what I'm saying? There's all kinds of stories of in Israel and everywhere else of suicide bombers getting cold feet at the last second. That's not the case with these kamikaze pilots. Like, these dudes were willing to do that stuff. Like, and that's where we get into ideology. That's where we get into people being brainwashed. You had a whole culture. We can get into their suicide culture, the honor culture stuff, too. I disgraced my family.
Wait a minute.
I'm going to commit hari kara.
Yeah, but hold on a minute, though. I know a lot of people like to say that kamikaze attacks were irrational and insane and crazy. But look, I want you to consider what the Japanese were experiencing when they started kamikaze attacks in earnest. Now, heretofore, individual airmen whose airplanes were crippled would make an individual decision to dive and crash bomb into a ship or other target. They would do that. It wasn't organized. It was just something that came out of their samurai, their interpretation of the samurai Bushido spirit. It wasn't organized. But remember, after 1944, it started the organized kamikazes began about the time of the invasion of the Philippines. And they were losing the war badly. Their conventional attacks were not having any effect. They were getting shot down in droves. They were not hitting their targets. Their pilots were not trained or experienced enough to go up against these highly trained American pilots with superior aircraft. So they looked at their odds. They said, look, we're losing this war, but we don't want to surrender. They should have surrendered, but they just couldn't accept that idea. So they said, since we're going to continue the war and we ain't going to surrender, we might as well make effective use of these men who are going to die anyway because they're getting shot down like ducks in a turkey shoot.
Yep.
So what they did was they said, okay, we're going to organize the kamikaze war. And actually, if you look at how effective they were, starting in the Philippines, and they got even more intense off Iwo Jima, and they reached the apogee at Okinawa, where they had thousands of them attacking in a concentrated manner. They were more effective than the regular attacks. They sunk about 50 warships off Okinawa and inflicted 5,000 dead sailors as a result of it. They were actually, in their way, more successful than any other tactic they had. And the United States Navy was really worried about the kind of losses they were taking off Iwo Jima from these kamikazes, to say nothing of the morale effect on their on the sailors who were undoing these incredible kamikaze attacks. And if you want to know what it was like to be under concerted, concentrated kamikaze attack, read the story of the USS Laffey. That is an un-be-fucking-leavable story. This ship was under constant, it was destroyed.
The terror the sailors were under with the idea that...
Oh, yeah. I mean, read the story of the USS Laffey. The USS Laffey endured 19, one little tin can destroyer, 19 kamikaze hits that hit the 19. They shot down like 12 of them, and they were under constant attack for an hour and a half. And it was never ending.
That's crazy.
This story is one for
that's
the books.
That's crazy.
That was more effective. Look, at that stage of war, given that they were not going to surrender, it actually made more sense. I'm not talking about from the human, moral, ethical viewpoint. I'm talking about strictly from the standpoint of military effectiveness. The kamikaze was the most effective weapon against the American Navy than any other weapon they had.
Hey, Robert.
No, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh.
We got you on Facebook
let me
Live.
Let me add
right
one
now.
More thing, too.
Oh, okay.
Let me just add one more thing, too. We hear so much about the nukes, which is a terrible thing, should have never been done, probably, you know, one of the worst atrocities committed in human history. But what people don't talk about enough is before you get to the nukes, the fire raids may have been worse. The infrastructure of Japan,
they were.
A lot of wood, a lot of that paper. And when those fire raids came through, they said it was like molten glass rolling down the street as if it was a river. Like that's how hot the glass was, rolling down the street. Talking about people just being evaporated on contact.
Evaporated.
And, of course,
fire
the constant storm. Screaming and people, you know, burning to death and everything else. Like, you got to read about those fire raids, man, because when they talk about the nukes, of course, we know the nuke story. No, this is in Japan.
The fire raids The fire raid on Tokyo. The fire raid on
wood.
The fire raid on Tokyo burned out 16 square miles of the city. 16 square miles. Over 100,000 people at a minimum were incinerated and burned to death. People were jumping into the lakes and the rivers and boiling alive in the lakes and the rivers. The bodies were piled up mountainous high.
It was instant, though. The you're talking about the bomb, right?
No,
I'm talking about the Tokyo. Tokyo was not atomic bomb. Tokyo was fire bomb. They burned out 16 square miles of the city of Tokyo. 16 square miles in one night in a firestorm generated by deliberately, because they had figured the science of setting a city on fire and creating a firestorm. They literally created a hurricane of fire that incinerated much of Tokyo and killed over 100,000 people in one night.
You're bringing that up is people always talk about the nukes. They never talk about those fire raids. And honestly, if you start reading the details, some of the stories from people, you know, the survivors from cities away and the medical personnel, that fire bombing was something serious. And again, a lot of wood and paper. And I would agree, sir.
It was absolutely hideous. It was hideous.
We had to bomb them again.
Japanese are okay now. I don't want to go back and bomb Tokyo anymore. Please relive it.
You know, you also got to put into the fact that one of the reasons why the United States was successful is because it had a free market automobile industry. And Keller, president of Chrysler at the time, I mean, if it hadn't been for Chrysler, well, you know, the story that we are telling today may be a little bit different.
A little bit different.
The United States perfected mass production. Henry Ford, he didn't create the assembly line, but he was the first one to employ it to the effect that he did, and it caught on in the United States to the point where they could turn out a B-24 bomber at Willow Run, a very complex aircraft, 400,000 individual parts. They could turn one of them out every hour.
Yeah.
A B-24 bomber rolled off the assembly line at the Willow Run plant one every hour when it was at its peak production.
When you take that General Motors,
this was a period with a stagnant economy too. So you get this huge shot in the arm, this war economy that's going to fuel that engine. And this lasts for generations.
It wasn't necessarily stagnant.
Head up over those nations. Compared to what
you
were dealing with at the time,
General Motors produced over a million automobiles, close to a million automobiles that year. But what happened is that this new bastion of need, where our allies needed the war materials, they needed the war materials, and the United States came to the call. That's what business people can do, y'all. Not lawyers, business people. They can turn things around and answer the call when the time is needed. And Sarge, what was the name? You're wondering, what was the name of that class ship that they was putting out like once a week or once a month?
The Liberty Ship by Henry J. Kaiser.
Yeah, that's it.
The Liberty
Ship. Just think about that. Kaiser came to the War Department, and the War Department was thinking about something like, I don't know. But he said, I can do it in half that time. Can you imagine that? He said, I can do it in half that time.
Wait a minute. Hey, man, Bianchi, when they got it right, there was a couple of shipyards that were building a Liberty Ship in 8 fucking hours from scratch. 8 hours. A Liberty cargo ship would roll down the shipways in 8 goddamn hours. Can you believe
That's
it?
Unheard of.
And they were just turning them out by the score.
Yep. They sure
were.
We were supplying our – wait a minute. Not only were we doing that, the United States was supplying its allies, the Russians, the British, Free French.
And the Chinese, remember? Doolittle had to take off about 250 miles short of the designated spot that they intended to because they had figured that out in the amount of fuel they can carry. So they took off after they were sighted. They had to. If not, then Japan would have been able to mount an offensive against them and probably dwarf that raid. But you know the funny thing about
They were worried about losing a Hornet. They didn't want to lose the Hornet. With the Japanese bottom, the Japanese trawler got out, the picket boat got off a radio message, and they intercepted it. And they knew they'd gotten off a radio message before they sunk them, and they were worried about a retaliatory raid that might sink the Hornet carrier group. They could not afford to lose one of their four carriers. The Lexington was sunk at the Coral Sea a month later. So they only had three fleet carriers. They sunk the Lexington at the Coral Sea. They couldn't afford to lose the Hornet and the Lexington.
And to go to show you how evil Japan was, you know, when Doolittle planes landed China and the Chinese put them up, later on the Japanese would go into China and massacre about 250,000 people, rape women, cut heads off, and all that stuff.
Horrible. Horrible atrocity.
But
quarter million people.
Remember this. What was it? 44 or whatever. When they had to go in there and refit the Enterprise. You know, put the booster thing around the and come back with the Hornets and all that stuff. The new airplanes and all that stuff. Put more guns on the and. They came back, and they came back. The Enterprise come back into one of the biggest task forces ever put together. One of the biggest seafaring wartime task forces ever put together in the history of the world. You know. So
Hey guys, I got news for you. The United States Commission from October of 1942 till the end of the war, United States Commission 26 fleet and light carriers. 26. Japan had eight. Eight. After my fleet and light carriers. Now, altogether, Japan had maybe a total of 19 or so. They just outproduced them by far.
Well, we kind of know
how. The escort carriers the U.S. had, Japanese had none. Japanese, Americans had all kind of escort carriers that could escort convoys with aircraft equipped with depth charges and bombs, and they would escort the convoys. There were little carriers that could stay with the convoy and carry a squadron or so of aircraft, and they could attack enemy shipping and submarines.
What do we got today?
We ain't got that many.
North Korea has more submarines, but they're the old diesel.
You know,
diesel electric.
What's Japan have today, though?
They don't have much. They got mainly a coastal, a littoral navy. It's not a deep water navy. Not anymore.
No.
They had one of the mightiest deep water navies of all time in World War II. But today, no. They have mainly a littoral navy that pretty much sticks around the coast. It doesn't go way out in deep sea like the World War II Yamato or something like that.
You know what mineral was worth?
Japanese built the Yamato, and nobody else has ever built a bigger battleship than the Japanese did. That thing was immense.
Yeah, it was like 4 or 5 football fields. You know what mineral was worth its weight in gold during that time? Chromium.
And
United States had a leaping start in chromium because what did our cars have? They was exclusive chrome bumpers, chrome trim, chrome window laces, and everything. Got to the point that the federal government imposed a sanction on chromium and said it can only be used in war supplies.
Yeah. Well, that's because we don't have a lot of natural deposits of chromium in the United States, but we had all this chromium, like you said, from all the bumpers that were laying around, and people were taking off the bumpers and throwing them in so they can melt them down and get the chromium off them.
Yep.
Because we're not just going to have a natural supply of chromium.
Yeah.
That's the one resource we don't have that much of. Same thing with nickel.
Right.
But those are two critical resources.
Studying those wars is every child, every school, it should be a requirement in every American school-age child to study not only the founding foundation, the documents thereof, but also those wars. Because those wars produce a people that have yet to be duplicated from my knowledge. And the Big E, the Enterprise, it had to be protected by spirits.
Yeah, you got that right. Either that one or maybe the Franklin. Did you ever see the battle damage that was inflicted on the USS Franklin and it still made it back to port? That was another unbelievable story. The Japanese kamikazes hit the Franklin, inflicted horrendous damage on it. I think something like 800 or 900 sailors were killed on that carrier, and it refused to sink. The stories of heroism and the fighting, the doing the battle damage on a ship were beyond belief. There's a famous documentary clip from that attack on the Franklin of a Navy chaplain, and he was awarded the Medal of Honor. His name was Daniel Callahan, and he's giving the last rites to a sailor who's dying, and he's praying over him. It's a very famous documentary still from the war. You may have seen it, maybe not. He's wearing a steel helmet, and he's kneeling over this dying sailor, and he's giving him the last rites. And that was typical of what was going on in that carrier. You got men running to and from in the background, fighting the fires. Captain Callahan, who was the chaplain of the ship, was leading damage control parties, pulling wounded out. I mean, he was beyond belief, this chaplain. I mean, you know, when he's given last rites, and when he's given a last rite to somebody to get up and lead a damage control party or to help the poor wounded out, it was just unbelievable stuff. I mean, World War II was epic. The heroism was epic. And it's a damn shame that children in schools are learning about some LGBTQ character is a hero and they don't know anything about people like Father Daniel Callahan.
Yep.
Yeah, damn shame.
You think about this. There were Asian / Japanese guys in the military, in the U.S. military at the time. Remember, there was this guy, he was a machinist by the name of Gato, that was on the Enterprise that when the Japanese first attacked the Enterprise, he gets into the back of a plane and starts firing the machine gun from the back of the plane and shoots down a couple of things to stop them from sinking the Enterprise, you know?
Didn't the Enterprise take a bomb through the deck that went down in what we would call the basin?
Oh, yeah, yeah, couple of them, right through the hangar.
That's a divine intervention, man.
Right through the deck hanger, man, went right through the deck hanger, exploded below deck.
Yep.
But, hey, man, if you want to know what the greatest story of heroism by the United States Navy in World War II, I still say it was the Battle of Leyte Gulf and the saga of Taffy 3. The little escort carrier group, the mightiest Japanese war fleet that they still had at the time, one of the greatest they'd ever assembled, and this little bunch of 7 destroyers and destroyer escorts and 3 escort carriers based off the Musashi, the Yamato, the Hagaru, all kinds of Japanese light and heavy cruisers, 14 Japanese destroyers alone, 3 Japanese heavy cruisers, 4 Japanese light cruisers, and 3 major Japanese battleships. And they turned them back. It is unbelievable. If you read the story of Taffy 3, and particularly the story of the USS Johnston, which is commanded by the first half-Indian, he was Cherokee, half-Cherokee Indian named Ernest Evan. He was lieutenant commander. And his story, that ship was commissioned, and he took command of the ship, he gathered his crew and said, look, this ship is going to move in harm's way. I intend to take it into battle and put it in harm's way. Anyone who's not prepared to follow me in that had better get off my ship right now. And he meant every word. And when it came to it, He charged these Japanese little fucking destroyers with 5-inch guns. He's going to get 16, 18-inch guns in the Japanese battleship. He's charging them, launching torpedoes, trying to draw them away from the helpless enemy American transports that were still unloading troops and supplies off Leyte Gulf, because that was their object. Because the Japanese had gotten by them, they would have massacred the American fleet in Leyte Gulf. And that was mainly transport ships loaded with soldiers, unloading supplies and soldiers.
All right.
Had to stop that fight.
And
it was the most one-sided fight in history.
Uh-huh. And the word that went
and they won.
Out from, and the word that went out from headquarters was Task Force 54. Where the hell are you?
Yeah, right. The Japanese had this plan to draw them away to attack carriers that didn't have any airplanes on them. They were sacrificing the last of the carriers in order to draw Halsey. He was very aggressive. They wanted to draw Halsey off to go after them because they knew he couldn't resist it. And that they took the, he took the bait. They went after him, and they sunk him. In the meantime, that left Admiral Kurita, who was leading the Southern Task Force to come through off the Samar Island and attack the American transport ships that were off the shore of Leyte Gulf, offshore in Leyte Gulf. And it worked perfectly. The only thing that prevented it from succeeding was this little group of destroyers, destroyer escorts, and three little escort carriers. That was it.
How is these battles going to help us in the studying the war effort in today's war?
Well, it always does. That's why at every war academy, look, they're still studying Napoleon's conquest in West Point. They still study that. They're studying Hannibal's victory at Cannae.
I don't know.
To teach you.
I don't know. I don't think we
something else. No, they do. I mean, they teach Julius Caesar's conquest of Gaul. They teach strategy and tactics are always translatable, even with modern technology, in modern terms.
The basic strategy and tactics are always useful. And the only difference with the strategy is the tools that you have used. And we can't forget that the shortage, you know, scrap metal was a thing back then. I mean, people would take their spoons, knives, and forks and turn them in. But look how the PT boats was built. They was built down with plywood because of the shortage of metal.
Yep. Birch
shell.
Oak. Yeah. But think about it, Joe. Look, strategy and tactics. Look, they studied Lee at Chancellorsville. Why do they study Lee at Chancellorsville? I was in the Civil War. Because it's about maneuver and strategy and deception. And look, all you got to do is use your imagination and you see how it can apply to modern technology. That basic stuff has not changed. That's why they study all these old ancient battles. Like I said, from classical times. Classical antiquity.
That's why it's an insult to be taking down a Lee statue. It's not who he was, but what he was able to accomplish that still gives you the cornerstone of what we're trying to do today. He was a genius, especially in the Mexican-American War.
Even though it was a big loss, the Battle of Thermopylae, is a big battle people still study. Because it shows you strategy-wise how to stand against a much bigger force, you know? They put them into that bottleneck at Thermopylae, and they massacred a ton of the Persians there, you know?
Yep.
When that happened.
Yep.
You know?
It's how you use terrain. They use terrain to their advantage, along with their very well-trained, well-drilled troops. You had a combination of elitely trained warriors and the skillful use of terrain to inflict those massive losses on the Persians.
Yeah,
yep.
Just like they studied Ramesses, who fought against the Hittites at the Battle of Kadesh. When he formed his troops, he had four divisions, 10,000 men each. He formed them in a V to make it look like it was much, much greater than what it was. And look what Hannibal did. Hannibal put fire baskets on the bottom on the backs of sheep and headed them down the mountain so that the Romans looked at him and said, look at all that. Scared the hell out of them. Those are strategic
things. Kiyaki, Hannibal's masterpiece was Cannae, where he wiped out three German Roman legions. That was his masterpiece, the Battle of Cannae. They still study that one all over the world today.
So you
a masterpiece of maneuver.
They build rafts to transport the elephants across the damn Mediterranean. Elephants are scared as hell. But can you imagine taking elephants up through those mountains like they did?
Mm. The elephants are a little tricky to handle, but yeah, I got to admire their ability to do what they did with them. Yeah, they did. They were a real shock weapon. They were like the tanks of their day, in a way.
They were the tanks of those days.
No doubt. But like I said, Hannibal's masterpiece was Cannae. Completely outmaneuvered the Roman legions. They did not expect the way they were attacked. He had them so hemmed up, they were unable to maneuver where he could maneuver his cavalry and his light infantry freely. And he had the Romans are hemmed in by their own numbers and was able to slaughter them piecemeal.
Yeah.
And the Romans, but you know what? The Romans, see, that's the thing about the Romans. They looked at why they lost. They changed their tactics and adapted, and then they were able to crush Hannibal. Because they were adaptable. They didn't stick with the same stuff and try to do it over and over again. So we can't fight like this again. This guy's too cagey for us to fight him like this again. And they changed their tactics and they prevailed. And what happened to Carthage? It was salted. It was sacked. It was burned to the ground. And they salted the earth.
Yep. One of the things, I don't want to change the subject or get us into something else, but we've got about 17 minutes left of the live show. If you want to call in and get on the phone for when we go into overtime, we've got about 17 minutes left of that until you can't.
But you know, the thing that disturbs me, and I guess I'm just getting old, hardly nothing mentioned about December the 7th yesterday. No, hardly nothing whatsoever. That is just deplorable.
It is. I grant you. It is. It's a damn shame.
That should
damn
be required.
Damn shame that things like that should not be remembered.
That should be required learning about American students. They should
absolutely.
Be mandatory learning about for American students. Well, now it's hardly mentioned. It's just shameful when you get out on the street and start interviewing people and ask them the simplest question, like how many months in the year, and they can't even answer that accurately.
Who did the United States fight in the Revolutionary War? The Italians? Oh, man, it's a shame. Oh, it's just so bad. It is so bad. They know how to put a condom on a banana, though. What a mercy. My God. It's just so depressing.
You talk about that in Sarge. You start talking about that, the phone lines will light up.
The phone lines will light up. Everybody be into that then.
I know.
The problem is, all of these heroic things that happened in World War II, a lot of it was in the Pacific. Some was over in Europe, The one I can remember is of a B-17 that got shot up so badly that its tail was hanging on by the wires and hydraulics of the back, and it made it back. And it made it back alone because nobody stayed with them.
Yeah.
Heroism like that needs to be told, needs to be taught to the kids.
That is the story of the B-17 called All American,
And its story is probably one of the greatest feats of airmanship in World War II. I read what that crew did to get that B-17 back after they were rammed by a German ME-109 that probably had a dead pilot at the controls. I mean, the waste gunner shot it up, and it kept going, and the pilot was probably dead. And the airplane just smashed into the aircraft right in front of the vertical stabilizer, just in front of the rib that goes in front of the vertical stabilizer. It slashed clear through, took off the entire left elevator, took the whole thing off with the left horizontal stabilizer and the left elevator, completely gone, ripped a complete gash in the side of the airplane. The only thing holding them together was the spar that ran, the central spar that ran from the central part of the fuselage to the tail. The tail gunner was still in the back of the plane, and he said he thought he was in a kite, and he was the tail on the kite because the back of the aircraft, the rear that was held there, was swaying back and forth, independent of the course the rest of the aircraft was taking. And he started to come out of the tail, and then the center of gravity shifted so much, the pilot told him to get the hell back in there. Because he said, whatever he did, his weight caused everything to shift so much, the plane really became unstable. So the tail gunner got back in the tail, and it settled down a little bit. And they got a picture of this goddamn plane, man. So another aircraft that was with it took a picture of it. And you could see daylight for most of the section at the back of the plane. Both, I mean, you could see where it had been cut completely through, except for this one spar that was holding the tail onto the plane. The B-17 was an incredible airplane. I don't think there's ever been any airplane ever built that could absorb that kind of damage and keep flying. And there's thousands of examples of aircraft like that getting back to base.
Yeah, they're
still flying.
What about that story of the bomber that landed itself? And they went to inspect it. Wasn't nobody on the son of a bitch.
Yeah, nobody on that. The crew bailed out, and the B-17 had such excellent flight characteristics. What they think happened was that an engine started again, or two of them got started somehow again after the crew had bailed out. And that plane had such excellent flight. But people, most of the pilots who flew it really liked it because they said it flew like a big old Piper cup. They said it was very stable. It was very predictable. And when it went into a stall, it stalled predictably. You could recover it, a spin, very easy for such a big aircraft, as long as you let it get out of hand. And that thing has such great flight characteristics, it probably could fly itself without a pilot and land itself under ideal conditions.
Yep.
I mean, B-17 was an amazing airplane. There's no two ways about it.
Well, I don't think what, fellas. But I hardly ever would say it, but I believe there's some ghosts on that plane.
It was just a good airplane, Bianchi. It really was. It's just a great airplane. And it could fly itself. It was so good. I mean, ask the pilots who flew it. They'll tell you. I don't know any pilot who was on a B-17 who said they didn't like the way the thing handled. Every story I read about it says the thing handled like a big old Piper cup. It was just easy to fly once you understood all the controls and everything. And that's why a lot of pilots who were heavy bomber crewmen liked it more than the B-24, because even though on paper the B-24 had it all over the B-17 in terms of speed, payload, range, couldn't fly as well at high altitude, but in almost every other flight regime, it had superior characteristics. But what they said they didn't like about it compared to the B-17 was the B-17 was much easier to handle in formation. When you had the whole tight formations, you had all that prop wash, and all these aircraft going up and down in the prop wash, the B-17 was easier to handle. It was a better bombing platform. Definitely take a lot more punishment, and they preferred to fly. The B-24 was kind of a handful to fly. Yeah, I mean, it had that little small wing, which contributed to its speed and its range, but it didn't have the stability or the strength of the wing of the B-17. So, you know, on paper, it was a better airplane.
I just
brought the B-24 kept falling apart.
It was a maintenance. It was a bit more difficult to maintain too. Yeah, that's true. But it was working enough. But it just wasn't the B-17.
You know,
Go ahead.
I don't know if this is true, but according to what I've seen, the first pilot to shoot down an ME-262 was one of the Tuskegee Airmen.
I don't think he was the first, but the Tuskegee Airmen shot down three of them on one mission, and that was kind of a record for a while. They shot down three in one mission. That was really a feat. I don't think they were first, though.
I've got a hell of a story for you, Ms. Gunslinger. What was it, last year or the year before? Remember that air crash they had at the air show here in Dallas? Remember that one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the B-17 that crashed.
Yeah. Okay. I was there.
Yeah.
I seen it.
Huh.
Okay. Now, about
10
years.
Didn't another airplane fly into it?
Fly into it, yeah. They got off their course, and another airplane, wham, right into that son of a bitch. I mean, it was, it was horrible. I seen the big plume of smoke come up as we were leaving, okay, because it was almost over. And I thought that was part of the air show because they was coming in for bombing, you know, how they bomb things, and they had fireworks.
Yeah.
They had fireworks out there on the runway to blow up everything and smoke and all this shit. Well, as soon as we passed the highway, which is Highway 67 right there, I looked up the highway, and they had that damn thing shut completely down. Cops everywhere, fire trucks, okay? But prior to that, about 10 years, there's only like about 12 of them at that time that were flying. They fly all over the country,
right.
Probably world, imagine,
right.
Giving shows, air shows and everything. And me and the pilot friend of mine, he had a little Cessna 150. We flew up to the same airport, and when we flew up there at his Cessna 150, one of them came in for a fuel stop, and we just landed, and we got out, and I said, "Damn, would you look at this? This is authentic. I mean, refurbished to the max." And my friend went over there and said, "Hey, can we go through this thing?" Didn't get to go up in it because they was in a hurry. But we got to go through that damn thing. I sat in the damn pilot seat. I walked over where the bomb bay doors opened. They had the machine guns in there. Man, that was badass. That was one badass fucking airplane. Did I say badass?
As far as I'm concerned, that's my favorite aircraft of all time. Just because of the legendary shit it was involved in. And the stories of airmanship of its crews. I mean, the stories that the guys did to get those aircraft back. Some of them, a single B-17 would fight off 9 enemy fighters, 12 enemy fighters all by itself. So there's one of them shot that got credit for shooting down 8 when they were attacked by about 15 German fighters. And this one B-17 took out about 8 enemy fighters by itself. It was a straggler. Yep. It had battle damage. One of the engines was out. The other was not making full power. So it was running on 2.5 engines. The turbocharger was shot out. It had to drop altitude down. You had wounded crewmen. The damn thing was a mess. It was sieved. And then all of a sudden, all these German fighters jump on it like a pack of wolves. And it fought them off.
You know what the funny thing about that is? While we was talking to the crew members there, I said, and I was looking around, looking up and down the thing inside, because we actually got inside to go walk up and down the thing. And I kind of said, "Where's the bathroom in this place?" And one of the crewmen said, "See that hole back there in the fuselage?" I said, "Yeah, that's the bathroom."
I remember hearing a story about what them guys were doing, and one of them said they had to stop doing they had a release tube in the aircraft, and I think it was somewhere around the bomb bay, but they had to stop using it because when they used it, the urine would go back, especially at high altitude, the urine would go down the release tube, and it splash on the ball turret gunner's or windscreen, and he couldn't see nothing. He had frozen piss all over the front of it. So they stopped doing it. They put it in an ammo can or a tray or something, and they tossed it out to one of the waste gun windows.
No shit. Wow.
That was another terrible job, too, that ball turret gunner.
Oh, yeah.
Because we had the land when your landing gear didn't come down. He was damn near just ridden off right then and there.
But if they could get him out, because they didn't land with the gunner that wasn't in the ball turret when they landed. He got out. You know, they had to rotate the turret to a particular position. If they couldn't rotate it so the escape hatch for the door was up, you couldn't get out of that goddamn thing. But whenever they came in for landing, the ball turret kind of got out. I mean, he wasn't in there when it landed, so he was out. But sometimes if you were trapped in there and he couldn't get out and the plane's got no other choice but to land, he's probably done for.
Yeah, he's just respawned on the runway or field or whatever.
Because you can't get out, but you can't get out of the thing unless the turret is in position. You got to rotate the gun straight down so the hatch is up inside the fuselage so you can open it and get out. If you can't get it in that position, you couldn't get out of the ball turret.
Yep, true. That's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah, war is a bitch.
Yeah, war is a bitch.
Amen. Y'all been talking about the war with Japan. Talk about the one with Germans. Well, that was
funny. Oh, that was the one that was really bad, though. That was a bad one. The casualties were much higher in Europe than they were in the Pacific.
Right. Think about this, though, guys. If Japan hadn't attacked America like they did, then according to the historians, there's a definite possibility that Hitler wouldn't have declared war on America. Some historians, I'm saying. So if that's true, I mean, because they were allies, right? They were the Axis powers, right? And it was one of these things where
They were allies formally, but the Tripartite Pact. They were formally allies. They signed the Tripartite Pact with Italy, Germany, Japan, and Italy in 1940. Signed a mutual assistance pact.
Yep, and that's the thing.
So
if one went to war, all of them had to go to war. So, yeah.
No, that's not the way it was written. That's not the way it's written. It was written so that if one of them was attacked by one of the others, they would be obligated to war. Germany was not obligated to go to war in aid of Japan because Japan attacked the United States, not the other way around. But he decided he was going to do it. Because he said the Japanese have the Navy that I don't have, and they'll be able to tie up the American Pacific Fleet, and they haven't lost a war in 2,000 years, so I bet you they're going to beat the Americans. That's the way he calculated. They're going to be able to tie up the American Navy, and my U-boats will be able to change supremacy in the Atlantic. And eventually, he said, I might have to go to war against the United States anyway. Now's the time to do it. That was his calculation.
And the other mistake he made, just like a lot of other people, is declaring war on Russia. You don't want to get into a war, particularly when you're having to go through Ukraine and stuff. Yeah, they captured some land in Ukraine, but once you took in Sevastopol and all that stuff, and once you get that land, it's hard to keep it, you know?
Yep.
And that, when the Russians came over to our, when they became our allies at the time, and they go in there, and we started supplying the Russians with guns and tanks and things like that, legit
condoms
stuff. really? Yeah. But once we start supplying them, that's when the things turned around and they lost, the Germans lost a ton of things over there in the Ukraine and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's
I hate to differ with you there, sir. I hate to differ with you there, sir, but if you read Mein Kampf, the entire purpose of the Nazi enterprise and the Third Reich was to take Lebensraum in the East. He said that repeatedly. The Lebensraum, the living space that the German people needed,
was in the East. It was in Russia and Poland. That's what the whole purpose of him doing what he was doing was about, seizing land in the East. That's why he was willing to let the British have their empire. He said he wanted to come to a concordat with the British Empire. Y'all can have your empire. Just leave us a free hand in Europe and let us take the East. We want Russia all the way up to the Ural Mountain. That was the objective of their enterprise. He could not leave Russia alone because he announced clearly what he intended to do in Mein Kampf. And every German had read Mein Kampf, or at least had a copy of it, because it was almost required for every German home to have a copy of Mein Kampf. So he, the whole thing with him was, and you got to remember, he knew Germany, not even though Germany was not as resource poor as Japan, it still suffered from a lot of raw materials, particularly oil. Germany was really weak in oil. So what he had to do was take that economic oil fields in the Caucasus. He needed that, and he needed the economic breadbasket that Ukraine was with its agricultural supplies. So one of the objectives of Operation Barbarossa, and this way he changed the thrust and the intention of the attack. He had Army Group North take Leningrad. You had Army Group Center to drive from Moscow. He had Army Group South to seize Ukraine. He diverted forces from the central effort, which was the most important one, to take Moscow, and he sent several panzer and army groups south to aid Rundstedt in his campaign in Ukraine. And that halted much of the momentum of the advantage of the attack in the center.
Yep.
And that's where he fucked up. Even though he knew he needed the bread, he should have waited until he'd taken Moscow. Because look, if you look at how centrally directed the Soviet forces were, it would be like cutting off the head of the snake. Now, if he'd have taken Moscow, yeah, the central direction of the Russian army would have been completely cut off. And remember what he did in Ukraine. The German army achieved the most spectacular encirclement battle victories in the history of warfare at Kiev, at Smolensk, and Vyazma. In those three battles, they took 1.1 million prisoners just in those three battles.
Yeah.
Yeah, then they ran up against two of the most formidable generals that the earth can provide, named General January and General February. You know, the Russian people, the Russian people, women involved, pulled up factories in the heart of winter. I mean, can you imagine? And moved them further into the inland, root through the permafrost and everything. Who in the hell are you going to find the gunslinger to go out in that type of winter weather and work? We can't do it today with all the modern thermal underwear and socks and all that shit.
I know.
It's amazing
that they did that. They literally uprooted factories and moved them beyond the reach of German bombers into the Ural Mountains, where they were just churning out tanks and aircraft. I don't know how the fuck they only a totalitarian state that can just order people by the hundreds and thousands to go start working like people working on the pyramids could do something like that, but that's what they did.
Mm-hmm.
They uprooted whole factories and moved them east.
The other guy that made a mistake in trying to do that was Napoleon. Because once General January and February came, the French had to retreat. Napoleon had to retreat, and they were cutting off the flanks of the horses to feed themselves at the time.
I wonder why they did that.
I wonder why they did
that. Because he overextended the supply lines. He didn't take into account one of the most important things in an extended campaign, logistics. The same thing with Hitler. Hitler overextended his logistical supply line, and he couldn't keep his troops supplied. Plus, you got to remember, the Russians had enormous partisan forces that were left behind in the wake of the German victories. And they sent in agents to organize these troops who had been cut off from their units, and civilians in the great big partisan armies that would harass the rear areas of the German supply line, ambush the communication supply line, and everything. They had to devote whole divisions to combat the partisans that could have been at the front fighting. They had 10 or 20 divisions just tied up against the partisans.
Yeah, the Japanese, they screwed Hitler over. Them dinks. They were supposed to invade Russia.
Yeah, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. Hitler was hoping that they would tie up the Russians and prevent them from reinforcing Moscow, the Moscow front.
Yep.
But
yep.
the Japanese didn't do it.
Yep.
If the Japanese had done it, then Stalin could not have committed those well-trained Siberian ski troops to the Moscow front. And that was what saved the day for the Russians.
Yep.
So they were moving
you know another thing that, hell, we wouldn't have had Louisiana. The final blow to the French was when Haiti defeated them. Little old nation defeated Spain, Britain, and France, which allowed the 15 cents an acre Louisiana purchase of Jefferson.
But I'm going to tell you something, though, man. People have got to realize that the central reason that Hitler started World War II was to get what was in Russia, Lebensraum. That was the central organizing theme around everything he planned to do.
Why?
He wanted to displace the Russian population and replace it with German settlers.
Yeah,
Germans
are
going to Germanize that land.
Well, what's the purpose? I mean, he had plenty of farmland. What's the purpose?
Like I said, you read what he – I'm talking about what Hitler thought. Read Mein Kampf. He said that was the rightful.
He was a psychopath.
Yeah, you see,
he was
look,
a psychopath.
This is what he said. No, this is what he wrote. This is what he wrote in Mein Kampf. He said, we have as much of a right to occupy and seize the lands in Russia as the United States did in their westward expansion. He looked upon that as his model. He wrote it in Mein Kampf.
Yeah, he was paranoid.
He
thought Russia had 162 divisions getting ready to come across the border. I mean,
yeah,
didn't he have
that wrong,
intelligence?
Didn't he?
I mean, what an idiot.
He said wrong, didn't he? You know what he said once in a private, in an unguarded moment? You know what he said to Heinz Guderian, the Panzer General of Panzer Group G? He told Guderian, had I known the Russians had this many tanks, because they had something like 8,000 when they said they had about 3,000 or so. He said, I never would have invaded when I did. Because he had gotten
his
bad
in the head right
that.
There.
I mean, Guderian was constantly arguing with Hitler, telling him that the strategy he was doing was all right. He was very upset when he diverted forces from the central drive on Moscow to go to Rundstedt in Ukraine. He said, keep the drive from Moscow going.
I know. Look what he did, though, man. He, you know, Germany, look how great the country was built up, and then he just destroyed it with dumb, stupid military moves he made. You know, he got lucky with France.
You got to remember, everything revolved around – Russia wasn't a mistake. It was the reason for Hitler being in power. That was what his ultimate objective. It wasn't to take France.
It wasn't to
invade England. It was to seize Russia, living space for the German people.
Yeah,
that's what he thought.
Living space.
Lebensraum.
Yep. When he first, the first thing that happened is they gave him Sudetenland, right? Okay. That's what the British did. They gave him Sudetenland, right? Then they came in there, and without firing the shot, they took Austria.
They took Austria first.
No, they got the Sudetenland.
No,
first,
they took Austria in 1936. Anschluss occurred in 1936.
Right.
But remember, that was a plebiscite. Remember, he had a plebiscite. Even though he did a lot of arm twisting and extortion, he forced the Austrians to hold a plebiscite where the people overwhelmingly, and this is true, They overwhelmingly voted for union with Germany.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a coercive, peaceful takeover.
Yeah. So yep. Then that idiot Mussolini goes to invade Greece. What a dummy, you know, and all his troops get kicked
well,
and
that
thrown
was later.
Back.
That was later.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, he
I
was
know,
talking about the Sudetenland. Look, the German Sudeten crisis triggered the Munich Conference, where
I really think,
where the Allies
really
yielded the Sudetenland
yeah.
to Hitler. What Hitler did
I mean,
was to foment, well, it was a combination of things. The Germans were, there were the German ethnic Germans in Czechoslovakia were being abused. They were suffering abuses at the hands of Czechs. But Hitler exaggerated it to create an incident so he could justify going to war against the Czechs because of the mistreatment of ethnic Germans in the Sudetenland. And they used this Wilsonian concept of self-determination in order to justify attacking Czechoslovakia. And its threats led to the Munich Conference, where the Allies just threw up their hands, bent over, and let Hitler jam it up their ass.
How did Mussolini get in there? How did Mussolini get in there? I mean, that guy, I swear, I think he was partially retarded. I mean, yeah, I mean, yeah, you look at
well,
you
gotta
the
remember,
video, I mean,
we got to remember, Hitler was, Mussolini, before the German army got really strong, Mussolini was threatening military action against Germany because of the troubles they were having with Austria in 1934 and 1935. And Hitler was backing down as a result of it. I mean, because Mussolini was very concerned about the German sphere of influence involving Austria. See, it wasn't a smooth sailing. Look, Mussolini didn't really get into smooth sailing with Hitler and get firmly on his side until 1938 with the Munich Conference. Before that, he was actually kind of belligerent with German intentions. The Anschluss with Austria worried him immensely because, after all, Austria borders Italy. And he's looking at the Germans right there on his border, and they're very aggressive, and he's worried about their designs maybe on Italy.
But he wound up... When he demonstrated the military in front of Hitler, right? They demonstrated the military. He had the planes go around in a circle, so it made it look like his Air Force was three times the size.
Oh, yeah. Hitler was good at that. Hitler kind of bamboozled by the planes. Yeah. He kind of bamboozled them. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But you got to remember, Mussolini was threatening military action against the Germans.
Now, they had a big navy now. Italy had a big navy. They had a very big, large
navy. They had a good navy. A first-class navy.
Another blunder. Another blunder by Hitler, Sarge. Another blunder, not getting a hold of France's navy. You know?
The British had a lot to do with that. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
The British had a lot to do with that. They sunk it, remember? At
North
Pearl Harbor. I mean, and it was ruthless. Winston Churchill, he said, rather than let these valuable ships fall into the hands of the Nazis, they killed, about 3,000, 4,000 Frenchmen when they sunk the British fleet in the harbor at Toulon.
Yeah. Churchill hated Hitler. He hated him. I mean, he just couldn't stand him.
But he was ruthless, man. Think about it. He killed Frenchmen. He killed thousands of Frenchmen to prevent the German Navy from getting those French warships.
Yeah, he was dirty.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Hitler, was it Spain or was it Portugal that Hitler supported? It was Spain that Hitler supported an uprising or something and put a dictator in charge in Spain?
No, he intervened. Spain. He intervened on the side of the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War with Franco, because Franco actually engineered a revolution against the communists who had seized control of the Spanish government. They were like socialists and communists, and Franco didn't want them in there, and Hitler decided to intervene on the side of Franco, the nationalists. Franco was a nationalist, and the commies were the Republicans. And Hitler intervened in order to support them for two reasons. Number one, he thought he could make the Spanish an ally when Franco took over. And number two, he wanted to use the Spanish Civil War as a testing ground for all these newly developed theories of air power, close air support, combined arms operations, and the emerging blitzkrieg ideas. So he said he had a double reason for going to support him. Just remember, that's 1936.
Yeah, that time period was medieval, man, medieval. All the people around the world were crazy. I mean, eating each other. I mean, it was crazy, the murder that happened during that time period of history. The human race was just, animals.
Hey, everybody, I'm going to interrupt for just a minute. Hold your thoughts. We are in the last 4.5 minutes of the live broadcast. So if you're out there and you're listening and you want to join us for overtime, call in now, 646-478-5284. And then also, we'd like to promote our other Blog Talk Radio hosts here. I'll start with me. Tune in on Sunday night, Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Should be a great show. My co-host, Valerie, is going to be unable to make it, so hopefully you all can join me. And then let's do a round robin and let Joe Gibson, Ron Reck, and Sally promote your shows. Let's do a round robin and do that real quick while we have 3.5 minutes left to do so.
A round what?
A round robin.
I heard of that.
Sally, promote your show.
Okay. Yes, American Statesman, Blog Talk Radio on Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We just have an open discussion about the issues of the day. We're going to be talking a lot more about the elections. What I was just kind of mentioning, as some of you may know, or have been listening to the show, know that there's been the discussion about the 24th Amendment and how the two political parties have taken over our ballot box. And I've been out there sharing information with our speaker, and they don't have the right to block us from just because I'm on NPA doesn't mean I don't get to participate, but that's what they've done. But I actually got a response to the email that I had sent out to the speaker, not from the speaker, but from a constitutionalist person. And I'm trying to get it set up for them to come on the show and explain the violations of what the RNC and the DNC, how our tax dollars are being used to finance their primaries. So stay tuned. I think we might have a legal case, might be developing a legal case to go after our voting rights. So please keep that in mind. The next couple of weeks, we're going to talk about what's all happened in 2023 and what 2024 is going to be. And please tune in. It's going to be interesting. And no show on Christmas Day. With that being said, I'll hand it back to you. Thank you so much.
All right, Joe Gibson, you're next.
I quit.
You're not allowed to. What do you mean? You're not allowed to.
No. You know when my show is
Tuesday.
Can't go
in the towel yet, Joe. Can't do it yet.
7 p.m. Tuesday. Call in if you can.
Repeat
7 p.m. Tuesday, blogtalkradio.com/Joseph Gibson, Restoring the Republic.
Perfect. All right. And then, Rick, you're next.
Hello, everybody. This is the host, Ron Rick of Crazy Nation Radio. You're tuned to CNM, Conservative Nation Media, on Blog Talk Radio. We're on the air whenever we decide to be so, especially after the Lorianne Show. It's Staten Hour this weekend, so come by and listen to the story. Anyway, welcome to CNM. Conservative Nation Media on Blog Talk Radio.
All right, we have Donnie has joined us. So, Donnie, take the opportunity to promote your show as well.
You go ahead and promote it. I'm kind of weak tonight. I ain't feeling too good. I had a rough week.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, hopefully you'll be, you know, rested up and everything for your show tomorrow night. Everybody tune in for Donnie C's show, Beyond the Mainstream, tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Lorianne.
Well,
What about Montana? Montana Joe or whatever. Doesn't he do a show?
I don't know.
I haven't heard of him, if he's doing the show or not. He hasn't let me know what his plans are, so I'm not sure.
Oh, and on Thursday night, guys, if you can find time, 10 o'clock, 11 Eastern, 10 Central, our friend over there, Von Weehunt, Blog Talk Radio.
That's 11 Eastern time? Trying to write this stuff down here.
11 Eastern, 10 Central.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. And we are now officially into overtime.
All right. I'm going to go back on the mute and listen.
Okay. I hope you feel better, Donnie.
Yeah, we do too.
Hopefully Cinnamon's taking good care of you.
But You know, the fucking the whole thing with we're spending too much, we need to cut off the money to Ukraine. That's why we're starting to hear fucking idiot over there crying because there's a chance we're gonna cut off the damn money to Ukraine. You know, and it's like, why do we have to pay all this money to Ukraine? Well, we know why, but because it's a fucking money laundering operation.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is what it is with Ukraine.
Well, he shouldn't be paying this aid. That money should go back in the pockets of the United States citizens. Don't make any damn sense. All the suffering, sacrifice, hard times, grief, extremely high, outrageous prices at the supermarket. Put that money back in the pockets of the United States citizens.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and also trying to force us to buy fucking electric cars and shit that don't work, that the technology isn't there. That's what they're going to try and do with us is, you know, fucking force us to, yeah.
Let's arrest you. Let's go. Let's get them going. Let's get it going. I'm ready. Every state, every capital. Start getting Rangers together, some kind of posse together, and go a step to our sheriff's. Hey, you guys got to enforce the law, or we the people are, one or the other.
Yep. And it has to be done one way or another.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a good damn idea. But look, fellas, I shot down that last Japanese plane. I'm damn near out of ammunition. I'm going to have to get off from here.
Well, it was good to have you guys.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he's right. That the only way that we're going to take back this country is by the way that the founding fathers created this country, only in the opposite direction. And that's with those pew-pew things. So, you know, those things that go pew-pew. Okay, that's the only way, because they're not going to listen. And I ain't talking about necessarily the government. Okay, I'm talking about criminals, too. They're not going to listen either because they're a criminal. You know what I mean?
Damn right. The one respect, guys, when Victoria Nuland, was Samantha Power, one of them that used a quote from Mao that said, power comes largely from the barrel of a gun.
Yep.
That's right.
You know,
this,
I mean, in one. Yeah.
Now, we have all these kids that are growing up now who do not know what the history of the United States is, but they're trying to tell us what the history is.
Trying to tell us. And we've been to it. You know, us older people that are on here, and I'm 59 years old. I'm old fart.
Old people.
But,
old people.
You know,
God, on an old people show? Oh, my God.
Yeah,
really?
Yep.
God, old fuckers.
You know, God. You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you really didn't have to worry about a whole lot of crime. Yeah, there was crime there, no doubt about it, especially in the big major cities.
But now it's filtrated through everything now. I mean, it's in the little city. It's out in the suburbs. It's out in the country, for God's sakes. Okay? Just recently, I started carrying 60 rounds in my gun arsenal on my belt. 60 fucking rounds. Because you know why? Yeah. Savage animals attack in packs. They didn't used to do that back
in
the day.
When animals attack.
Yeah, when animals attack. They usually just one-on-one. But today, my God, it's more than two, three, four. What are you going to do when you run out of ammo? Know what I mean?
I think I have that CD collection, When Animals Attack. I think I still have that in my library.
I used to love watching that.
Who was that guy? That one guy who was a cop.
Yeah,
he did all kinds of crazy. He did narrated shit.
Well, Ron, the Gunslinger, that's when you need your short barrel AR-15 chambered in 300 blackout with about a 7.5-inch barrel, maybe 9-inch barrel. It's an easy-to-carry truck gun. Carry one magazine in it, three, or maybe a pouch, or three extra magazines, and it's very easy to conceal in your vehicle.
Yeah.
And you say,
Or one of them little bitty Uzis. Them little Uzis, I'd love to have 9mm Uzis. Oh, my God. Sheesh, I'd love to have one of them. Woo. Yeah, there you go.
Mac 10.
If I'm carrying an AR-15 with a short barrel, it ain't going to be chambered in 5.56. It's going to be in .300 blackout because it needs velocity for that little teeny tiny bullet in 5.56. So you get the 300 blackout, you got 125 to 147 grains going supersonic even out of a short barrel. So,
yep.
But you still got the mag capacity. You got the ease of handling of an AR-15, and it's very easy to conceal it in your car or your pickup truck. It's a perfect truck gun.
Yep.
You know, with me, back in the 20s and 30s, what made the Tommy gun such a deadly implement of weaponry was the fact that it had that knockdown power. You know, 45 caliber, whatever it was. I mean, you get hit with one of those bullets, you know, you're going down, you know. Yep. And it was, what were they throwing out about a, what about a, 500 rounds a minute or 1,000 rounds a minute?
Oh, no. The model of 1921 would throw them out at over 800 rounds per minute. They slowed it down for the model of 1928 to about 550 to 600. But
right.
The 21 model would spew them out pretty close to as fast as the MG42. They had to slow it down. They thought it was just too fast.
Right. And the thing with the Tommy gun is, had it not been used in all the fucking drive-bys and stuff, it might have been a good weapon to take into World War II. I mean, it might
They did have Tommy guns in World War II.
They didn't have them. It wasn't, from what I understand, they didn't use them on a really, really widespread basis. You know?
Oh, no, they were pretty widespread. The Thompson and all its variants. Now, the problem with the Thompson was it was expensive to manufacture. That's what it was. So they came out with a simplified version of the 1928 A1, which was very expensive to manufacture. They called the M1 Thompson. And then they came out with an even more simplified version called the M1 A1, and that was kind of the standard submachine gun for the United States Armed Forces. But then they came out with one that was even cheaper than that, the M3, the grease gun, and they were trying to replace the Thompson with the M3. And the M3 was actually the solution they were looking for because it was very inexpensive to manufacture and they could issue them all over the place. But they issued a lot of Tommy. They made over 1 million Tommy guns during World War II and they distributed them throughout the armed forces. They were very common to with NCOs in the infantry squads and paratroopers. Very common. Saw a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Oh, and tank crews, they put them inside of tanks with the tank crews. So they had a lot of them. They manufactured quite a few.
Right. Yeah. Well, I love if we can get that Firearms Act of 1934 just out of here, I'd love to own a machine gun at some point.
They all need to go because they're all unconstitutional. Did the Founding Fathers, when they set up the Second Amendment, did they specifically mention machine gun? No. Even though it wasn't invented yet, okay, granted, but they knew that the firearms were going to advance, I mean exponentially, over the next 100 and something years. So they figured that they just said just guns, weapons, whatever. They didn't specify caliber or what type. So, yeah, you should
specified.
Be able to own the same thing this government does.
They
sure.
said arms.
Oh,
they
okay.
said arms.
Said arms.
Arms, yeah.
And this is what I know they meant. Now, what I'm about to say, I know they meant this. They wanted the militiaman to be equipped with the ordinary arms of the infantry soldier. That's the kind of arms they meant because they were talking about a militia. So whatever contemporaneously the ordinary infantry soldier was carrying, those are the kind of arms they meant to be available for the civilian militia. And today, that means a selective fire, intermediate caliber, standard capacity magazine, shoulder-fired assault rifle. That's the kind of weapon they're referring to.
Yep.
That's what the ordinary infantryman carries today.
You can still flip it to fully automatic, right? It would still be a fully automatic.
Yes, select fire. Well, select fire could be burst fire or semi-auto, but some sort of selective fire mechanism, meaning mainly automatic or semi-automatic, yeah.
Wow. And rightfully so. I mean, you know, because what was the original intent of the Second Amendment? In case the government got too goddamn big for their G-strings, which is getting kind of close. Which is getting kind of close. Really,
yeah, that's one reason. And also to act as a conventional military force in the event of enemy invasion. It was both.
Invasion, both, yep. Right. And what's so terrible about it?
So, hey.
Yeah, the United States has not ever been invaded on the shore, except in Britain when the Founding Fathers were shooting at them. That's really the only time that they've been that America has been invaded on the soil itself. You know,
1812. Don't forget the War of 1812.
Well, two times. Okay, only two times then, out of the whole 40-something years of this country, whatever. It's just twice the soil has been in danger. Okay, other times they've been over there fighting these other banker wars. That's all they've been, banker wars. You know that. Money, money, money.
Would you include the Mexican-American War in that one? I don't think I'd include that one. That'd do with.
That's still on the same continent. Mexico, you know, neighbors over there, that's still on the same continent. I'm talking about from overseas or from the ocean attack or anything. Like that, the admiral that blew up Pearl Harbor there, you know, he said, I heard you say a while ago, well, there would be a gun behind every blade of grass if I tried to invade America. You know, and that's the truth.
Well, let's not forget, though, I know what you might say about the First World War, but don't forget, the First World War, what triggered the United States to declare war on Germany was the Zimmerman telegram to Mexico telling the Mexicans that if they intervened on the side of Germany, Germany would see to it they would get some of their old states back. That wasn't fabricated. That was proven to be true. They did send a telegram to Mexico and they resumed unrestricted submarine warfare in the Atlantic, and they were sinking our merchant ships. So that was definitely a cause to go to war right there.
Yep.
So, I mean, World War II, and then in World War II, you had Adolf Hitler declaring war on the United States. What are you going to do? Ignore it? You got to declare war back.
That's the old thing goes, why you never take a knife to a fucking gunfight.
who's going to win?
Yeah, that's true. But I understand what you're saying about many of the others, you know, like Vietnam and the Gulf Wars and all that other stuff. Yeah. You're talking about something that you can kind of see where there might be other interests other than strictly American interests. World War One and World War Two, pretty clear cut. Spanish-American War, well, you know, the whole thing with, you know, the battleship Maine and Manila Harbor, you know, what really caused it to blow up? Okay, well, a little suspicious there. But, yeah, I get your point.
Over there.
Yep. Hello.
Hello.
I'm a first time caller.
Oh, you first time caller. My God.
Yes, this is the first time I called in tonight.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd throw something up at you guys. It's gonna be pretty bad. It's not gonna be good. I'm not gonna tell you something nice that you really want to hear, and everything's gonna be fine and fucking dandy. It ain't happening. Okay, I'm doing a show after this goes over overtime, so. Check me out tonight. It's Alex Jones night, and somebody needs to call George Sensor and let him know that I'm doing the Alex Jones show tonight.
Yay!
Okay.
His long lost brother has been found. Hallelujah!
Anyway, I thought I'd make that announcement. Like, I can't post it because I'm on this show right now. I can't, you know.
When are you going to start it? 11 o'clock.
When are you going
to start it?
11 o'clock. So I'll back out earlier from this one, then it'll start at 11. So anyway, just get ready for a fun ride, all right?
About 45 minutes.
Put the door hit in the ass on the way out.
It's night on Crazy Radio.
And
on it,
and,
PBR.
And guys, we're talking about...
Or NPR.
You know,
NPR.
We're talking about...
And
guns.
By the way, before I really shut you up, Mike, real quick, why do you all talk about weapons and guns? Why don't you just give it to Jesus? Let him figure the shit out. That's what they say. Let him figure it the fuck out, you know? All right. Go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry, bro. I mean,
he is going to figure it out.
No, he's going to figure it out. It's us, we the humans, that have got it right yet. Yeah,
the firearm, you know, assists people in introducing them to Jesus, and then Jesus can figure it out.
Well, how do you do it? Do you Jesus first, guns first? Gun, Jesus, gun. Which way? I'm confused. You know, I figure the gun could react faster to my prayers than Jesus. I got that. Okay, I'm going to go with that. So we
always
have to deal with
Jesus
it from there.
Jesus
first. Oh, that's what you say first when you grab that gun? Jesus, motherfucker. Okay, I got it.
Sometimes,
Well, Joe, I know disrespect, brother. I know you're religious and kid and Christian and all that. I mean, I don't have nothing
to
do
with religious. No, I'm
not
religious. No.
I thought you seen the burning bush or some shit, man. Something one night drunk coming out of the board meeting somewhere.
I'm not religious.
Okay, well, I'm trying to be. I mean, but Jesus and God's, we can't
you
set
get
this application, right? No,
you
can't set the application.
I'm
a rock musician, and I'm demented. I can't do it. Marilyn Manson's my little brother. You know, I can't help that.
You know,
Ozzy Osbourne's my older brother, you know. So, I mean.
Ozzy? Oh,
yeah.
Lord.
The Oz. Yeah, man.
He's more religious than anybody.
Yeah, so is Alice Cooper. Did you know that? Alice Cooper's religious.
Ryan James
Dio.
Alice
is just characters. Yeah, they're just characters, man. That's but people don't know that either. That's funny stuff. Not the rainbow in the dark.
You play some Dio tonight?
I can. Yes, I can.
Yeah,
man. Absolutely. Yeah, I play some Dio. Matter of fact,
Holy Diver.
Yeah, there you go.
I played some Skid Row the other night on my show.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Quick sand, Jesus.
Maybe I should play Godzilla, too.
No. There you go.
You know, there, Godzilla. He picks up the bus and he puts it back down. Godzilla.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. We finally do karaoke tonight. We'll do that, too. I don't care.
Well, I know my music now.
I'm not a billboard. Really? Okay, that's cool. Finally, somebody. Jesus, Mary. The other one that's really good is Rob's wife, you know, Suzette. I mean,
oh, really?
Done karaoke on my show. Yeah. She's real good. Yeah, I'd love to have her for a backup vocals. I really, really would. It'd be great.
She got some good tunes. She could sing real good.
Oh, she's got some bites on her, man. Absolutely. You know, I'm a screaming rocker. You know, I'm a screamer, you know. There he is. So you're gay. Yeah. You scream, Ron. Well, I have to because, you know, it's what the job calls for. Fucker, you know.
Yeah.
Especially if I play Hagar, shit like that, you know. Hagar's a screamer.
Oh, wow. Hagar, he gets those pipes going.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I just got gifted with that talent, you know, to manipulate different voices, you know. So it's kind of pretty cool.
What do you think? Hey, let me ask you a question. What do you like, Hagar or Roth? I always went with Hagar.
Well, Roth is a showman. He's not nothing but that. He's not, you know. I mean, he was all right this time, but he turned too arrogant and too much of a jack-off.
Yeah.
He's too stuck on
even
himself.
Eddie
he was separate. He was separate. Well, in the beginning they did, but he was separate from the band. He wasn't part of the band, you know. You know, matter of fact, it came a conversation with Michael Anthony over the issue of that. And, you know, of course, you know, Sammy and Michael Anthony are inseparable. You can't separate those guys.
Yeah.
They just became the best fucking friends ever known to man. And Michael Anthony is one hell of a fucking singer himself. A lot of people don't know that either. But Michael Anthony, you watch
him. I didn't know that. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, that guy's bad to the fucking bone, man. Go look at the one where they did the Golden Earring song, Highway. Where Michael Anthony starts the song out. You know, and it's unbelievable what pipes this guy got. Yeah, it's crazy. Chickenfoot. Yeah, that's Chickenfoot. When Hager was doing that one. But, you know, Sammy's a smart guy, man. Smart guy.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to meet him years and years ago, many, many years ago. I was a little young rocker in the circuit, you know, when he was just Sammy Hagar before he became, you know, Van Hagar.
Can't drop
55. One foot on the brake and one on the gas. Yep.
That song really put him on the scene. That's what happened. That song put him on the scene.
Yeah, that made him famous. That did do him. But he had a lot of good songs, too. Remember the Heroes?
Yep.
Just tons of them that Sammy did. I always liked, you know. What was the one? Well, I got discovered doing Hagar, Three Lock Box. I was driving my car. I was giving this guy a ride to guitar player. I played with another band, you know. And I didn't know nothing about them. Anyway, Hagar came on Three Lock Box, you know, and I sung it. You know, hear me. This guy was sitting there fucking in shock. He leaned up against the door of the car. And he goes, "Motherfucker, you could sing like that?" I said, "Well, yeah, man. What the fuck's the problem, dude?" You know. He goes, "Geez, I ain't heard nobody fucking pipe like you except Hagar himself." I said, "Well, that's cool. You wouldn't think about leaving your group and coming hanging out with us?" I said, "I don't know about that."
No, you know what? You know what? You know who I didn't like really too much? Gene Simmons. I never cared for him too much.
He was always an arrogant Jewish jack-off, but, you know, there's a lot of them. There's some of them, you know, in the music business. I have met a lot of people in the business, okay, a lot of them. And, you know, the thing is, some are as nice as fucking people to Christ you could ever think. You know what I mean? I'm extremely fucking nice. Some are kind of arrogant, and some are just straight-up jack-offs. That's just there's no other way to say it. I mean, they're so stuck in their fucking self, they can't fucking stand it, you know. it's sad. It is, man. And they don't realize this ain't forever. You know, I had to come over to Plan B. I mean, dude, check this out. I had played with some of the biggest names in the music business. Biggest money. I've made tons of money, right? Okay, but here's the deal. I own an automotive repair shop. I own a towing company. Okay. Plus, I own a food trailer. Okay, I don't ever stop being in some type of business. I'm always a businessman, okay? And I made a lot of money doing that, too. But you've got to have a backup plan. Okay, here's I hate to take over the show. Anyway, my great-grandma they used to fish. Okay, they owned a lake, a big fucking lake. Anyway, my grandpa bought that thing for like $3,000 back in the early, I think, 1920s. You know, that's how we're talking ancient shit here, okay? But anyway, back then, that was a lot of money. I mean, that'd be compared to $300,000 today. So anyway, my grandparents sold fish, okay? Well, and I was a little kid, and, you know, they used to slave me to death. I was a little slave. I mean, I used to cut the grass with a push mower, pick strawberries, and I had to clean fucking fish, which isn't a fucking job. I'm telling you right now. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I was the only grandchild that ever showed up for. Why was it? Because most of my other cousins were blase fuckers. You know, the silver screen fuckers, their family had money, blah, blah, blah. My fucking guy had cash. So that's how that worked out. You know what I mean? So they don't have to do things like, we have people come to our lawn. You're going to do nothing. Well, they're going to get
fat. No, I can't stand that.
So I can't either. I can't stand it. Matter of fact, my aunt died. And nobody ever informed anybody in my family, my side. My mom's, you know, my mom's my mom's sister, you know. Nobody notified anybody on my mom. My mom's already been gone. But anyway, we never notified my aunt died. Well, ain't that fucking kind of stuck up cocksucker, isn't it?
That is.
So anyway, one of my cousins showed up at a gig that I played in St. Louis, okay? And I seen the motherfucker there, you know, and I brought that up. On stage, I brought that fucking up. So, I mean, it was nobody knew what the fuck I was talking about. That motherfucker did. But anyway, that's fine. It's, you know, but that's the way families have become nowadays. Nobody cares about anybody anymore, their families. Mom, dad, fuck them. Forget them. Fuck them, forget about them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's sad. Grandparents, too. People forget about them, too. That's another thing.
That's really sad, if you ask me.
Right.
You know?
But you got to remember, some of these musicians have completely got their heads so they're into
so,
their self.
Yeah,
so
far
they,
their act.
Right. You know, what was the fucker's name that seen a reflection in the water and fell in love with himself? Narcissist.
Narcissist
or some shit like that. Yeah. So that's kind of how people are, you know, in the business. And, you know, once they hit the money, you know, like Kevin from Navarro, okay? Kevin was cool when he was younger, but Kevin became another one, you know. You know, and it's why him and Gary Richrath fell to pieces and shit, you know. But, I mean, Gary had a bad drinking problem, and I admit that. Gary was a bad drinker, big time, big fucking time drinker. He loved his dope. He loved his drink. That's how that man was, you know.
That's how a lot of them were back in the 80s, the 70s,
well,
too.
Yeah, we were rock. Well, it was kind of the fucking deal. That was a rock band persona. You had to be a fucking drunken fucking drug addict.
Yep.
You know, sometimes you had to get fucked up to play.
Yeah,
I never
got
that
far. Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Yeah, I was gonna say that. Yeah.
Yeah, but I never got that far into it, man. I was smarter. You know,
how about Bob Seger?
Bob Seger's good people.
Mm-hmm.
Very good people. But he's a real musician, though. That's Bob Seger, you know. You know, he wrote from the heart, not from the head. You know, type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
remember that show Miami Vice? They used to always have some rock stars on there. They had Nugent on there, I think, one time.
Yeah, Nugent, I'm not a big fan. I'm not a big fan. I'm good. Good. I love Phil Collins a lot, but Nugent, I'm not a big fan because he's a draft dodger. So
yeah.
Said, you know, that wasn't cool. I mean, I like some of his songs, but you know.
Yeah,
you
Danny
don't see
Yankee.
Me playing Barry. Yeah, well, mm-hmm. Danny Yankees was good. Because I remember who was involved with that too. You know, it just wasn't Ted Nugent. You know, but.
I didn't know he was a draft dodger.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know
sure the fuck. Yeah, sure was, man. Yeah.
All that talk he does, too. Man.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, that's where I kind of see when he's doing interviews and shit like that. He's like, you fucking douche. You know, why don't you be telling the fucking truth, Ted? You fucking pussy out from going in fucking Vietnam, man. You know, and he did. I mean, look it up. You'll see. You look under the fact that he was a draft dodger. He stayed dirty for like a month or two, never took a shower, just looked total like dog shit. Then when he went he was drafted in, they rejected him because, you know, he was fucked up. Looking, hell of an actor. So, you know.
Yeah,
now he's
a
national fucking star. Wouldn't he think everyone would say, well, wait a minute, weren't you fucked up before? Well, we're
Call him a patriot. They gave the patriot. They call him, like, claim he's like this big patriot. The motherfucker was a draft dodger.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, man. So, I mean, it's kind of, but like, you know, like I said, man, the music business, it's anymore, it's kind of fucking, you know, what can I say?
Well, how was it today? How is it today? Or better yet, we know it's pretty shit today, but how about the early 90s compared? Because we know the Seattle movement came onto the scene, right?
Well, after the 80s, it was over. It was over. Rap came in, and it was over. It was over. And rap had a short life, like disco. Disco had a short life, too.
Yeah, I know.
You know it,
wow.
It's like, you know, people ask me, you know, look at pictures of what I used to look like before and what I look like now, and now I look like an old fucking man, you know, but and I don't have the long hair anymore like I did back then. I look like David Coverdale. That's exactly what I look like. A lot of people thought I was David Coverdale.
That's how I picture you, too. I never seen a picture of you, what you look like. I'm just going to make
a voice.
Yeah. David Coverdale.
Yeah. You look like lead singer Whitesnake. Oh, great. Fuck like I care. You know, I just have long, blonde, beautiful hair. That's all there is to it.
Hey, is it true? Is it true Coverdale and Robert Plant hated each other?
Yes, that's true. They did.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. That was there again. We're talking to the style clash. You know. One said one thing, one said another. It's like, that's more of that dilemma there between the two. It's more like soap opera shit to me, man.
He's trying to copy this guy, he's copying him.
Well,
you
Robert
know.
Plant is a hard guy to deal with too, though, man. You know, I've never actually met Robert Plant. I've been near him, but never talked to him, you know, and I heard he's kind of a condescending prick too, you know, a little bit.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I heard about that too, gossip.
Right.
Yep.
Right, so I mean, it's, you know,
he's anal, he's anal retentive, you know.
There's
anal retentive.
Right. And see, the other thing about there's secrets inside of the rock music business people don't know about, and I really don't want to talk about, you know, what it's really about.
It's not
what people think it is, man. It's just it ain't there. You know, you are marketable. You are a piece of fucking livestock. You ain't what you think you are. You think you're all glitz, glamour, glory, light limousines, get all the pussy you want, and snort all the fucking dope, but trust me, you don't come unmarketable. Wow. You ain't worth a fuck no more. Nothing. And they don't care. That's the other thing. They don't give a fuck about you.
Yeah.
You
know, you better
get in the top 100 somewhere, at least. But now, today in the music business, today's music business gone. Rock music. Okay, let me explain this to you real quick so everybody can understand the time era of what's happened. Well, we went from the 80s rock, okay? Then we went to rap, okay? Then we went to, you know, thrash rock. Bullshit, you know.
Yeah.
The song "Down with the Sickness," I like it. But anyway, I like playing it, like singing it. But anyway, then it changed from that to country rock, and it's still.
What about the metal years? What about the metal years?
Metal years were the fucking 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Okay. Two big metal era time frames. You between 19, I say. Well, your hippie trip music. There's some like 65 and dance music, you know, the bebop shit, you know what I'm saying? The, you know, Debbie Gibson stuff. Yeah, Darce Day and the fucking Flying Nun and shit, too, like that. You know, the thing between, after that, going to this country rock, which rock took over rock music, country did. They impregnated both of them, you know? If you listen to any country music today, listen to it. You know, you're hearing electric guitars more often, more and more steel guitar work, and, you know, it's more of a rock thing, and it starts picking up, you know. That song, She Thinks My Tractor's Sexy. You know, that song, for instance, look how fast it is. You know, she thinks my tractor's sexy, really turns her on. You know, she won't forget me. You know what I'm saying?
It
ain't like the old original country music, you know. But that's what happened to it. That's what happened to the music.
In your opinion, all the years you've been involved in it, what was the best time, you think?
The '80s.
I agree.
Right. And now, even though I'm older, I mean, I'm 57 years old now. And, you know, the thing is, I'm getting all these offers recently from bands, these tribute bands. You know what I mean? And I got this one in California I went and played with a couple weeks ago, and they're just, you know, begging me to come there to play. And I'm like, dudes, I don't live in California, man. I mean, what you're doing is it's excellent shit. It is good shit. You know what I'm saying? But the problem is the majority of the population has never heard of these fucking guys. It's a sad thing. It is sad, you know? But no, if I mention, you know, I mention, okay, man, do you know who the babies are?
Nope.
You know, nobody.
Yep.
Not a fucking soul knows who the babies are. You know, but they were great, you know. Well, yeah, you know.
People don't know, even though you ask them who Linda Ronstadt is. No one even knows who the fuck that is.
Right, yeah. She was sexy. I liked Linda Ronstadt when I was a kid.
Linda Ronstadt and the Stone Ponies?
Yeah, I was really surprised. I watched a couple of weeks ago on The Voice, one of the contestants did an actually excellent job on a Linda Ronstadt song. I can't remember which one it was, but I was like, wow, I haven't heard anybody do a Linda, you know, for a long, long time. So it was kind of big. She did a really good job of it. She has like a natural voice for it, but she kind of put her own spins on it, but it was very tasteful. It was like, you know, honoring the original, but also kind of putting her own flair on it, and her voice kind of naturally fit. And so I was pretty impressed. I forget who the contestant is now. I'd have to look
cool
it up.
When
but
I, do that,
I was like, wow, blast from the past.
But when you get these tribute bands trying to sound exactly the same as the old original, you know what I mean? And, you know, they do have followings. Some of them do catch on. Believe it or not, I hooked up this AC/DC band who's doing AC/DC shit, and they had a hell of a following. It was surprising. You know, these guys definitely did good for themselves, you know. But it's just, you know, one of those things that tribute bands don't last long either. You know, you're a bar band, more or less. You're just copying another person's work, you know what I mean? You're like Weird Al Yankovic, the only thing you're just keeping the words the same. You know, you ain't changing. You ain't going into parody mode. You know, so,
did he pass away? Did he pass away?
Who's that? Weird Al? No.
Oh, I thought he passed away.
Not that I know of. Hmm. But I see, who was it I seen on Newsday? Dead guy. Oh, fuck. What famous actor died today.
Yeah, I was going to mention Denny Lane, co-founder of the Moody Blues, which the Moody Blues is one of my mom's favorite bands, and co-founder of Paul McCartney's Wings. He just passed away yesterday, I believe.
Yeah,
at 79 years old, Denny Lane.
Wow. And you got to play on your son. I was thinking about playing on my show since it's holiday time. He's always played up north on the rock stations. Adam Sandler's the Jewish song there.
Yeah,
you ever hear that one?
Hanukkah.
Yeah.
Hanukkah. Yeah.
Hanukkah.
Not a Jew.
Yeah, I played his song on Thanksgiving night. I played. Brian O'Neill is one who died.
Yeah.
Brian O'Neill, 82 years old. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ron. He died.
Right.
Yep. Today, I believe.
Yeah.
At least that's when I saw the story. After
Ryan O'Neill. Ryan O'Neill.
2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. My mom always used to say that I looked a lot like Tatum O'Neill, who was, of course, in Little Darlings. Of course, that's not a movie that, you know, is featured on any streaming services for family viewing. Little Darlings with Christy McNichol, Tatum O'Neill.
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of them who've been actually kind of dropping out of there. I know when I was in the 60s, one of my favorite groups was the Monkees. I loved them, but... You know, the way they started was totally different from everything else, but they're all dead now, aren't they?
I don't know. I don't know.
I think Mickey Dolan's still alive.
Okay, yeah. I haven't heard anything about him dying, but I know the rest of them are gone.
Pretty much, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Desmond died last year.
The monkeys you're talking about? But then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer.
Laurie, I think you're talking about Ruby Lee that did a Long, Long Time by Linda Ronstadt.
Yes.
She's good. She's actually trying to bring back some of these songs that have been forgotten, you know, some of these artists, old school artists and stuff. And I actually really love it. Since on The Voice, they can't do their original songs or anything, you know, so they have to do other songs. And She's been trying to focus on a lot of those songs and artists that have, like, you know, gone from the past that nobody really listens to anymore. And that's why I like her. Yeah.
Yeah. that's something that, you know, I used to have a group, and I was a drummer for the group and the singer too, but it was
a drummer?
A long time ago. Yeah, I'm a drummer.
Wow. I didn't know that.
We're brothers. Fuck.
During the time we were my group was together and we were doing good things, I designed a drum set that I had Gretsch build for me. It's a double bass drum set, but I only had one bass drum, and it was oval shaped. And had Sin drums on it and everything, and I've got that in storage.
Sweet.
Neil Robert, Robert drumming.
Yeah, my drumming came in at, well, I was a guitarist. I mean, I grew up playing guitar, but 2112 album Rush, that sold me. That was at the end of my guitar playing. I had to be like Neil Peart. There was no other way fucking around that. I had to be that guy. You know, I did. I made it and got to meet him. I got to spend time with that man, you know, which is a ton, you know, wow. You never would have believed it. In my young days when I was beaten at the air on 2112, I would never believe in my lifetime that someone would make an arrangement for me to meet that man, and I did. So, you know, that's just an honor I'll never forget. But anyway, I got a question for anybody. Anybody heard that song called Back on My Feet Again? Heard that song? Back on My Feet Again, dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
Who did that?
By who?
Who did that song? Back on My Feet Again. I was so lonely until
baby.
I met you. For myself, I get by without love. It's a baby, see? There's a song. They know it. They don't know who did it, though. So there you go. That's what that group is trying to pull off. You know, they John Waite was great. John Waite was good on his own.
Yeah,
he got big in the 80s. So
yeah, he did. He did. Everyone knew he was in the 80s. Yep.
Hello, Cindy.
Okay, you guys. Everybody's gonna think my neighbors think I'm crazy because you were asking who sang Back on My Feet Again. I'm out here in the middle of my backyard with a dog, going the babies. Damn it, it's the babies. Like crap, I'm on you.
Here comes the ambulance.
And I'm the one that got it. Ding, ding, ding.
Crazy woman in my yard.
Cinnamon and I are of like minds again. It's crazy how much Cinnamon and I have like a connection brain-wise or something.
Oh, it's a scary thing.
Yeah, I didn't even think of the babies when it came to that, because I know the Monkees did a song called Back on My Feet Again. I think it was back off of their Headquarters album, and that was a long damn time ago. So, and I kept thinking of that, and then one of you sang that, and I thought, nope, that's not it.
my voice is not that great. I'm not tuned here as well, but, you know.
I used to have a decent voice, but too many years smoking cigarettes and smoking pot screwed my voice up.
The cigarettes will fuck you up.
I used to actually sing Winona Judd really well and Stevie Nicks. My voice really fit really well with those two.
I could never sing nothing.
I did not even
in the shower.
I did a karaoke thing one night about 8 years ago or so, something like that, and they had a contest, and I won that contest by doing a Bob Seger song. It's called The Last Resort.
Okay.
And it has some real high in it.
Come here, pop off here. Okay, hold on, I'll call her.
Okay.
Come on,
okay, Ron, you call her. Make sure, don't forget.
Blondie. Remember Blondie?
Blondie. I love that. I love their stuff.
So, Laurianne, the Ruby Lee girl, the first song she did for her blind audition was I Want to Be a Cowboy Sweetheart by Patsy Montana. Old school country.
Speaking of Montana,
Yeah, and then she did Jolene, not Dolly Parton's Jolene. I forget whose Jolene. It was a different song by Jolene she did good. And then she did Blue. She did Long, Long Time.
Yep.
And then Reba McEntire's You Lie. She actually brought Reba McEntire to tears singing her song You Lie, honoring her coach because she's on Reba McEntire's team.
Well, hey, kids, I got to run. I got to run, kids. All right, I'm going to get up here, and I'll see you in another 15 minutes or so. All right?
Yeah.
All right, see ya.
All righty.
But yeah,
see you in a little bit.
But this is a really, really talented young woman, this Ruby Lee. You know, I like listening to her. She's going to be big one day.
If you guys want to listen to her Linda Ronstadt one, I could upload it real quick. Hopefully if I can find it on YouTube or something before the switchboard goes down.
I got something.
Although it might
you,
be copyrighted, so I can't download it very easily.
Yeah. Okay,
I've got the other one.
I've got the first one up and running. I can play that one over the phone. Yeah, if you can, you know. So I'll do that right now.
I'm trying to get my uncle, man. You guys won't believe this. This guy here. He's awesome. Let me see if I can get him.
Let's see. Oh, yeah, I'm getting it. So let me see if I can upload it real quick.
I wish I had something from him.
I know the one song I like Bob Seger's Get Out of Denver, and I use that for my ending theme song, but I don't get to play it very often because we usually go way over into the Ethernet after the...
Wait a minute, here's my, hang on, if I can get him, damn, man, if I can get him. Oh, Gene's videos, hang on.
Okay.
If I can get him, man. You guys won't believe it, This is my uncle singing, you won't believe it, he's awesome. Oh, let me see, hang on. If I can get him. Hey, what the fuck, that? Son of a bitch. Hang on, all right, here's my uncle.
I am weak. But thou art strong. Jesus came here from all wrong. I be satisfied in his love. And I want everyone close to thee. Just a closer walk with thee. Friend of Jesus, it's my plea. Stay walking close to thee. Oh, let it be. Oh, let it be. When my feeble life is o'er, time for me shall be no more. God, don't say free, Lord, to thy kingdom shore, to thy shore. Just a closer walk with thee. Bring Jesus, it's my plea. Let it be. Oh, let it be.
That's my Uncle Gene, man. He's good, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's good. Yeah, Gene Noyes. He's on my Facebook
page. Really
that's my uncle. Huh?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Good boy.
We've got a bunch of me.
Lori says she's got that Ruby song uploaded, so.
Yeah, Ruby Lee on The Voice singing Long, Long Time by Linda Ronstadt. I'm going to go ahead and play it real quick.
All
right. Love will fight.
Oh, my Lord.
Take things in stride.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah, didn't she do good? And she can yodel. Like, this woman can yodel, too. Like, she's just got that thing, you know. And so in some of her songs that she's done, you know, she's, showcased her yodeling skills. And, yeah, she's really talented.
Yeah, she's got a beautiful voice. But, you guys want to end the show and maybe we can go over to Joe's? Or
you mean Ron Rex?
In the hour and... Everybody's quiet.
Everybody's crying. They had to go find their tissues.
They had to go find their tissues.
From listening to Long, Long Time.
Yeah, that was pretty.
I just sent you a copy of my uncle's, Lori. I just sent you an instant message to my uncle's video. He's got a whole stack of them, but he dedicated one to me. That's my dad's brother. He dedicated one song to my dad, actually. So he's awesome, man. This is my Uncle Gene. I mean, where he's singing from, where he's sitting right there in that video, I've been up there. That's his little office up in his little red firehouse he has. They call him the mayor of Tracy. So he's an old biker from years ago. But, yeah, he's awesome, man. You thought that was professional. You thought that was like Johnny Cash or something, huh? that's my uncle. He's doing that just on a guitar up in his little office. That was him. I sent Lori Ann the video.
You really want to hear a tearjerker from a young artist in the chat room there. They're right there. Oh, boy. You talk about an uprising talent. And the little girl's only 15 years old.
Wow.
Check that one out.
I'll have to.
It's in French. It's in French. But, you know, music has no language barrier.
No.
I mean, this
really
right here
would
make grime.
Yeah, actually, that's it. What I mean, can't
I? Yeah, it would make a grown man cry. I mean, it's really, wow, powerful.
Yep.
She's Dutch or Holland, I think.
Let me send you his Facebook link. Hang on. See if you can, because maybe I can't. Maybe that's because he can't send out his videos. I'm, that's weird. Hang on a second. Let me send you his Facebook. He's not private. I know he's not private. I don't think he is. See if you can get access his face. See if you can access his Facebook. I know he's not private. You go to his videos and they'll be all there listed. I think it's a public profile.
And only shows two videos. None of them are him singing.
What are you talking about? A Facebook page?
Hang
on. On his Facebook page, if you go to Gene's videos, if you go to videos, and not videos of Gene, just go to Gene's videos, you'll see all. He's like, I got 70 of them up there. You can access his Facebook page.
I can only see two under Gene's videos. One with a barbecue and one that's about 4 minutes. But it's not one of the songs.
Is his profile private?
For only friends to view or something.
Is his profile private?
No, his profile is public, but his posts are limited. There's only two videos under Gene's videos that are public.
When you click on his profile, do you see posts about friends, photos, videos, check-ins? Do you see that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I went to
click
videos,
on
and I go to Gene's videos, and there's only two.
Really?
That I can see.
Wow. I wonder
so
how come there's only
one. For only
friends. Yeah, must be. Yeah, wow. I thought they were private. I mean, public, all his videos, huh? I wonder why he did that.
Yeah, and I don't see posts by him. I see friends that have posted on his wall that friends of friends can see, but I'm not seeing anything actually posted by him.
Well, if you friend him, he'll accept it. But he's got some awesome songs up there. I mean, he's That you should see a cabin up in Vermont that he's got. Oh, it's beautiful. It's right on the tip of a mountain. Oh, man. Yeah, he never wanted to record none of his stuff professionally. You know, he just kept it all just, you know, I mean, he could be like a number one hit. I mean, he's awesome. Never understand them, but I guess he just does it as a hobby, you know. Some musician, I guess, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you can't see all. Surprised, yeah. I didn't think his thing was private because he don't give a shit. He's crazy. He was a crazy son of a bitch back in the day. He beat the crap out of a Walter cop.
It's probably just set that way by default, and he doesn't even realize it. You know, I've had to go back and go, oh yeah, I have, you know, by default I have my posts friends of friends. And then I go back in, and the ones that I want to make public, I make public, you know, and I adjust them after the fact.
Okay.
You probably just, But I usually have my stuff for friends of friends, not just friends only, you know, so that if you post something of mine on my profile, you know, and they're a friend of yours, then your friend can see it, kind of a thing, too.
Gotcha.
Awesome.
But then, like, if I'm applying for jobs and they're scanning my public posts, then some of that stuff I don't want to have public, you know.
I don't care. I mean, I put everything public.
We're like about 30 seconds away from the show recording part ending. So.
Yeah, we should make our way over to Ron Rex's show then. His show is going to start here in a minute, and we can all make our way over there. to Crazy Nation Radio.
And I'll go ahead and start the ending theme, and we can get out of here and go over to his show.
Right on. Make sure to tune in for Donnie's show tomorrow night.
God bless you all.